Chapter 17. What the Storm Brings. The Obsidians escort me to new quarters, Fitchner trailing along behind, pacing jovially on the marble floors. When we reach my door, he takes my hand.
Well played, boyo. Good reading on her. Knowing she wants what she can't have. Gory damn clever. Warms my heart to finally see you playing the game and winning, you little pisser.
He slugs my shoulder.
Tomorrow, we'll go to market and buy you servants. Pinks, blues, obsidians of your very own. For now, I left you a present.
He gestures into my room, where a lithe pink lies on the bed.
Enjoy.
You don't know me at all, do you? He sighs and leans forward.
This is the hand life has dealt you. It's not a bad hand. Imagine the things you can do as a personal emissary of the Sovereign.
She makes your governor look like a small-town slumlord.
You have your girl. You have your opportunity. Embrace your new life.
The door slams. A new life. But is it worth the cost? I don't know what's happening with the Sons. That's something I can't affect. But he expects me to let Roke die? To let Tactus and Victor and Theodora perish to Praetorian death squads? I walk around my suite ignoring the pink. Luna's night clouds sprawl as far as the eye can see beyond the huge bank of windows that comprises the suite's north wall. Buildings puncture the clouds like glittering spears. I am trapped by opulence. Rain continues to pour. The storms of Luna are enigmatic creatures. For a man of Mars, it is a slow rain, lethargic, as though the drops tire of their own fall in this low gravity. But the winds that come are gales. There are no cracks in the Citadel's windows through which the wind can whistle. I miss the moans of my old castle on Mars. Miss the laments of the deep mines. Those moments when the drill cooled, and I sat there touching my wedding band through my fry suit, thinking of how soon it would be that I had her lips to mine, her hands on my waist, her body drifting light as dust over my own. But I cannot think only of the red girl. When I see the moon, I think of the sun. Mustang burns in my thoughts. If Io smelled of rust and soil, then the golden girl is fire and autumn leaves. Part of me wishes I would remember only Io, that my mind belonged to her, so I could be like one of those knights of legend. A man so in love with one lost that he closes his heart to all others. But I am not that legend. In so many ways I'm still a boy, lost and afraid, seeking warmth and love. When I feel dirt, I honour Io, and when I see fire, I remember the warmth and flicker of the flames across Mustang's skin as we lay in our chamber of ice and snow. I examine the empty room, which smells neither of leaves nor soil, but cardamom. The room is too vast for my taste, too rich. There is ivory on the walls, a sauna, a massage parlour adjacent to a pleasure chamber. There's a comm chair, a bed, a small swimming pool. These are my chambers now.
I see in a data file that I've been given a 50 million credit stipend to choose my attendants.
They left me an additional 10 million to populate my harem. This is the price they pay me for betraying my friends. It is not enough. My eyes now fall on the pink who lies on my bed, naked, covered only by a blanket. I threw it on her to mask her form, thinking of poor Evie when I first saw her. But the longer I look at this new girl, the harder it is to remember Evie, to remember Io or Mustang. That's what pinks are for. To help you forget. So effective, they even make you forget their own sad plight. When she grows old, she'll be sold off from the Citadel staff to some high-class brothel, and a few more lines will form, and she'll be sold down the ladder and down the ladder till she has nothing more to give. It happens to men. It happens to women. And, I'm beginning to realize, it happens to golds. The pink asks me to join her, to let her soothe what ails me. I don't reply. I sit on the edge of the windowsill, my hands kneading my thighs, waiting. I don't have my razor. Obsidians guard the hall outside. The glass window won't break by any means I have at my disposal, but I do not worry. I sit watching the storm, feeling another brew inside myself. With a hiss, the door opens. I turn, a smile already cracking my face. Mustang, I... Through the door slips a demure male pink with white hair and eyes that'd break 1,000 hearts in Lycos. It breaks mine now. I was wrong. Who are you? I ask. He sets a small onyx box down on my bed in front of the other pink. Who is it from? I demand. You'll see, Dominus, he says. Daintily he extends a hand to the other pink, who, confused, takes it and follows him from the room. The door closes. I'm just as confused as the pink. I rush to the box, opening it, and find a small hollow cube. I activate it. Mustang's face appears, glowing. Take cover, she says. The power goes out, and the door locks by default. The room is plunged into darkness. Lightning lashes through the clouds outside, thunder rumbles, and I hear something. A howling. It is not the wind. Another flash of lightning and he appears, floating in the bitter storm like the ugliest angel ever shit out of heaven. A wolf pelt hangs from his shoulders, whips in the wind. His black metal helmet is that of a wolf's head, and he's armed to the bloody teeth. Severo has come, and he's brought friends. Lightning. Thunder again, and this time it illuminates his slash of a smile and the 8 floating killers behind him. 9 howlers in all. Small, cruel little devils, waiting in the darkness, silhouetted by the crackling of the storm's electricity. Long-legged Quinn is there too. I duck into the sauna as Severo touches the glass with a pulse fist, after setting up a jam field to absorb the sound. The glass ruptures inward. The distorted sound of the storm follows them as they thump down onto the carpeted marble floor. Wind whips at my bedsheets and tapestries. One by one, they kneel. Pudgy Pebble, Cruel Harpy, Spindly Open-Faced Clown, and all the others. Friends, get up, I bellow. You're already short enough. They laugh and rise. Pebble and Clown rush forward and weld shut my metal door with plasma torches. Water drips from Severo's hook nose as he nods toward me, his helmet absorbed into his armor. Hair buzzed in the shape of dragons. Quiet and so full of derision, he hefts a huge, heavy bag in his other hand. And when he walks, he moves with disdain for this low gravity, as though it were a thing for weaklings and fools. Lord Reaper, you look like a pixie ponce in this lady den. Severo sweeps into a theatrical bow after he places the bag at my feet. Perhaps that's why Mustang believed you were in dire need of your gory damn pack. She brought you back from the rim. All of us, Quinn says. We've been here several weeks on standby. She needed men she knew wouldn't be loyal to the Sovereign. An insurance policy. I can't believe I ever doubted her. In no world would Mustang help kill her father. I realized during my conversation with the Sovereign that it had to be why she's here in the first place. To infiltrate the Sovereign's family like I infiltrated the Gold's. As she entered the Sovereign suite, I remembered how before the duel she mentioned having her own plans. Now it finally clicks into place. They were both playing their own games, but I helped reveal the Sovereign's hand. The Sovereign wasn't worried about me knowing anything, else why play the game? But as soon as Mustang entered the room, the paradigm altered. She should have concluded the game then and there, but her pride got the better of her. As for Mustang, I knew she was with me as soon as she took the gold horse ring I gave her from her pocket and slipped it onto her finger. My heart leapt in that moment, and I knew she'd find our way out of this. Severo, I smile and clasp his hand. Our arch-governor is... I know. Mustang briefed us. Come here, you tall devil. Quinn steps past the others and slips her thin arm around my waist and kisses my cheek. She smells like home. I have missed these people. The wind howls as it passes through our jam field. Severo's bionic eye glitters unnaturally. Quinn has brought me grav boots, ebony in color. I slip them on. Mustang might have brought us from the rim, but we didn't come for her. We didn't come for Augustus. We came for you, Reaper. Severo snarls. Quinn frowns as Severo spits on the pretty carpet. We saw what you did to Cassius, and we want what you're trying to make. And that is? I ask, more than a little confused. What poor killers always want. War, he growls. And all its spoils. What of your father? He has a high place now. Fitchner is a shit-eater, he sneers. He's made his bed. Let him sleep in it while we burn the house down. Well, if you want war, if you want spoils, we better move. The arch-governor's the one with an army. Quinn nods. And Roke's down there, and Tactus. Tactus, Severo mutters, though I know the sneer on his face is for Roke. He watches Quinn, eyes sad for the smallest moment, before adjusting his armor. So what's the plan? I ask, and take the razor Pebble offers me. Severo and Quinn look at each other and laugh. Mustang's fetching a ship. She said you'd figure out the rest, Quinn says. Just then the door behind me shudders and glows with a dilating pupil of red-hot metal, and I notice something. The bag that Severo threw down. It moves. Severo smiles at me. I know that smile. Severo? Reaper? What did you do? Mustang brought us a package. Let's just say... Quinn grins at my shoulder. It's not their cook. I unzip the bag and gawk. Are you mad? I ask him. He just howls. Chapter 18. Bloodstains. Father once told me that a hell diver can never stop. You stop and the drill can jam. The fuel burns too quickly. The quota might be missed. You never stop. Just shift drills if the friction gets too hot. Caution comes second. Use your inertia, your momentum. That is why we dance. Transfer movement into more movement. Uncle Nerol always told me to stop. He was wrong. Blew so many drill bits because of him. Then again, Nerol lived longer than Father, so maybe he has a point. My howlers jump with me out the window, and we don't stop when we dive into the black storm. We freefall, piercing the clouds without the use of our grav boots, like black rain screaming toward the ground. I'm first. I feel them behind me. My howlers. The oxygen is thin at first.
I hold my breath. My eyeballs nearly freeze in their sockets. Tears trickle out. My body shivers as the cold wind bites me. We use our grav boots now to cut across the citadel, skirt among the clouds to keep from sight. Villas beneath, buildings, gardens and parks, barracks and statued plazas. A ripwing cuts through the sky. We slide behind a spire and stick there like spiders till our scanners say he's passed. I shiver amid my armoured friends. Then we float down again, a kilometre from the villa. Weed carries Severo's present now. Slung around his back, it weighs him down a bit. I land on the wall that surrounds the villa and separates it from the other compounds, where the other notable families hunker in fear of what the night brings. It's warmer now that we're lower to the ground. Howlers land around me, looking like gargoyles on the wall. Darkness claims the villa's grounds. We're early, I wonder. No signs of fighting, but the lights are out. Or late, Severo says. If they were murdered in their beds, this is to look like a Bologna massacre. The sovereign won't want to be implicated. But what does that even mean? The Bologna would come with greys, obsidians, golds, and despite all their vaunted honour, they would destroy every last woman and child with any means at their disposal. You do not let your foot off the throat of an enemy and remain powerful, as they have, for hundreds of years. The killing will be silent, though. The sovereign may control the citadel, but chaos would bring unwelcome eyes, unwelcome variables, and it would make her look weak. Better to have the act done. Better to say the Bologna did it, and damn what anyone thinks. With the Augustans dead, what is the point in mourning them? That's how Goles think. But if they are alive, having escaped assassination, well, that's another thing entirely.
Quinn. I lean close so I can hear her whisper. Visual is too clear. If they have optics, they'll spot us up on the wall.
She points to the roof.
We can make an incursion there, sweep down, level by level.
I hear the worry in her voice. We'll get Roke, I say. Promise. I pat her arm.
Severo, how long till we have the shuttle?
Mustang is 10 out.
I pop my neck and rub the rein between my fingers.
Per aspera ad astra. Through the thorns to the stars.
Severo snickers.
You fancy little fart. Omnis vir lupus.
Everyone a wolf. The howlers flash smiles to one another, and we rip away from the wall.
We land on the roof, silent and dark.
Weed stays on the high wall with Mustang's present squirming in the bag. Predators, we stalk over clay tiles, in through a window on the villa's seventh level, two at a time. The place is a complex. Dozens of rooms, seven levels, fountains running throughout. Baths, basement, steam rooms. Their infrared is worthless, then. Too much hot water going through pipes. It's quiet as a crypt in here. We creep along, checking the bedrooms, flowing like water around one another as we did at the Institute.
Severo and Thistle ghost ahead, scouting. Grav boots deactivated so the hum can't be heard.
There's not a soul to be seen. Every room empty, beds unmade, including the Arch-Governor's. The Augustans are not here. So where are they?
They've no military armaments besides some armor and razors and a few pulse fists. The bodyguards were wiped out before they even returned to the villa. Augustus and his entourage couldn't have climbed the walls. Perhaps they flew away on grav boots. But they would have been spotted, shot down. We only slipped in because we're unexpected.
Captured?
Severo asks.
No. For the Praetorians tonight, the only good Augustan is a dead one.
Pop.
We all look at one another. A jam field has just gone up, a big one. We're inside it. Likely the whole villa complex is inside it. Something's about to happen.
I glance out the window and see a shadow moving across the garden lawn. Three shadows in the rain.
I duck and signal Severo. Praetorians. Ghost cloaks.
My heart makes my ribcage rattle. He moves to the window, about to jump out to try to kill them. I pull him back.
What the hell are you doing?
I whisper. He scowls.
I want to kill someone. Not yet, damn it. We're not an army.
No one on the seventh level. We go down a circular marble stairwell. Their oiled armor creaks softly, echoing down the cavernous stairwell. We can see the marble of the first level more than 100 feet beneath, but no movement. The first blood is found on the sixth level, seeping from the steam room. Pull the door open, heart throbbing into my throat, ready to see mutilated goals. It's a sadder sight. More than 20 pinks, browns and violets thought to hide in this room. The Bologna and Praetorians found them, killed them. It's a queer sight. Each death so clean. Jab wounds to the skull. Just shows how little chance these poor servants had. The golds put them down like cattle. I search through them frantically, hoping not to find her. Praying. She's not here. Theodora must be with the rest of them. A cold rage fills me. I feel it seep into the howlers. We find the first dead gold at the stairwell down to the fifth floor. An old knight of my house. His death was not pretty. We find another dead man farther on by a grav lift. He fell as if defending the lift while others descended. Out the window, I glimpsed the Augustan lancer who mocked my skills with the razor only a day ago. She rushes from the house to the gardens. A shape coalesces out of the darkness. A gold Praetorian with purple fringe to his black armor chases her down. Two Bologna obsidians hem her in, forcing her to turn straight into her pursuer. He kills her with one swing. Nothing to be done. Her death is so fast. One moment she is panting, fearing, running. The next, both parts of her fall to the ground. These Praetorians don't play with their food, Severo mutters. Quinn looks at me, her eyes tracing the absence of armor or a helmet. She offers her own. I ignore her.
Darrow, we didn't come all this way to watch you die of a blow to the head.
Get off it, I say. Roke will write 1,000 gory poems if you get so much as a bump on yours. Keep the helmet, Q, Severo begs, if only because I hate poems. I let my borrowed razor slither into my palm and move through the level. At the door of each room, my blood races. I expect to find Roke's corpse, expect to see Victor's mangled body. Severo holds up a hand at the fourth floor stairwell and motions me forward. I slip toward him with Quinn and peer down. Dust rises up the circular stairwell. Beyond it, on the bottom floor landing, shadows move. But there is no noise. Severo bends and places a piece of debris on the edge of a banister, gesturing me to watch. The howlers cluster round, staring at it, and I stiffen. Though there is no sound, the piece of debris rocks slightly. Vibrations in the building. Before Severo and the others can stop me, I jump over the banister and rip down the center of the spiral stairwell with 10 times the velocity this moon's gravity would allow. Pop! I enter the domain of a second jam field, and sounds of war rattle over me. Concussive blasts, yelling, burners hissing out bullets, pulse weapons warbling like demented ghosts. The moment before I land, I tweak my grav boots, jerking myself to a powerful stop. I slap into the marble and swing my razor round my head in a violent loop. 4 Praetorian greys die. 8 thumps hitting the floor. Their ghost cloaks disintegrate like thin window frost against hot breath. Bodies strewn across the halls, rubble, fires, greys and obsidians chased down Augustan Golds. 6 greys overwhelmed 2 Golds with rail rifles, magnetic ammunition screaming into Aegises till they overload and warp backward, consuming the Golds' left arms. Rounds slap into the pulse shields that cover their bodies, overloading the circuitry. The greys slip forward with practiced precision and shoot the Golds point-blank in their helmeted heads. The best armor in the solar system crumples inward, and the man and woman are gone. The greys turn in my direction, level their rifles, and my howlers cascade down around me. Their black aegises throb against the vambraces that cover their left forearms. They block the incoming fire. Severo slips from formation. Quinn follows. Ghosting, they flicker in and out of sight, moving as twin strands of smoke. Somehow they're among the greys, then back by my side before the greys fall. More weapon fire slams into our formation, nearly taking my naked head off. I duck behind my armored fellows. Terror pumps through me. A grey pops into the hall and fires a micro shot at us. 30 tiny bombs spread out like a swarm of hornets. Thistle and Rotback blast the swarm apart with their pulse fist. A sheet of blue fire billows through the hall. A second swarm of bombs howls after the first. Quinn shunts off the power to her grav fist and shoots at the swarm of bombs just before they hit. They reverse course, back the way they came, where they slap into the grey squad and detonate. We won't last in here. Nothing will, I decide, when 3 Bellona obsidians lope into view, Carnus Au Bellona following at their heels. Some of my friends will die on this level if we fight all who come against us. There's a better way. A smarter way. Severo, make a hole! I shout, pointing 7 stories above us, up the center gap in the stairwell. He shoots his pulse fist upward, and chunks of stone rain down around us, suspended by Quinn's grav fist. Severo shoots again, and water rains down through the hole, swirling in the gravity bubble Quinn created. I stand and yell, "On me!" We ascend out of the chaos before the Praetorians fall on us. I come to a halt 200 meters above the villa. Wind whips. I had no plan when I dove down to the first level. I thought only of my friends. Now I know the howlers and I will be killed if we fight. I let my razor curl placidly around my arm. I instruct the howlers to do the same, and I roar into the darkness. Aja! The howlers close around me, nervous as we float exposed above the villa. The storm sends sheets of rain down on us. Aja! A horde of Praetorians disengage their ghost cloaks near the hot springs and lagoon, where the infrared is thrown into chaos by the heat of the water. 2 Praetorians rocket up from the garden, cutting through pine trees. 1 a stained. He flies closer, leveling his iron fist at my head. Get that thing out of my gory damn face, you stained whelp! Don't you recognize your betters? A Praetorian Gold joins him. I don't recognize the woman. Her serpent helm recoils into her purple-black armor, sleeker than the obsidian's. Face sharp and ruthless as an axe head. Varga, heal! She snaps. The stained lowers his weapon. His helmet slides into his own Praetorian armor, and I discover Varga is a she. An obsidian, a head shorter than I, with a tribal tattoo consuming her pale face. White hair flutters behind her. More scars on her face than I have on my entire body. Ebony dog, Severo snaps. I'll shoot her if she snarls again. Were you the squad in the stairwell? The Gold glances over us, unsure of what to make of me or my howlers. You killed my greys. Don't weep over greys, I say. They raised their hands against me. Why are you here? She wipes the rain from her face. The Sovereign confined you to your room for the night. Are you responsible for the power outage? My business is the Sovereign's. She can't afford not to believe me. She pauses a beat, and I realize she has optics in her eyes. She checks the database.
Liar!
The Stain's weapon comes back up.
You know who I am, Praetorian,
I say with as much authority as I can muster. You also know I'm not on your list to kill. I have immunity.
Revoked. So take me to Arja.
Arja isn't here.
Don't lie to me.
Her optics flicker in her irises, and she receives a digital command.
Follow me.
We land on white stones and follow the Praetorian through the trees toward the lagoon where the hot springs terminate.
What are you doing?
Severo whispers in my ear, eyeing Varga. He flips to the woman the crux with his middle finger wrapped around the index.
I'm using your leverage.
Arja stands in the garden, flanked by Bellona. Two gold, the rest obsidian. Only the one stained, Varga. The lagoon breathes tendrils of steam around the Protean knight's shoulders. She watches the water impassively, like a child watching a campfire waiting for a log to burn.
Darrow?
Arja purrs without looking at me.
You're not in your room.
She sizes up the howlers, recognizes them.
And you killed my men. Fichtner was wrong about you.
I have something you'll want, I say sharply. But call off your dogs.
They tried to escape before we came, even with their grav boots confiscated. Foolish attempt. They tried to contact the Julii, but they've been bought.
Victra, I ask.
She betrayed us.
Alive, with the rest. She'll be spared thanks to her mother's cooperation. Two Augustan ships made an effort to run our blockade in orbit. We shut them down. The Augustans are like cornered badgers.
Lions, I remind her. She flicks blood off her razor.
Not quite.
Are any still alive? I keep the panic from my voice and glance back at the villa.
The prizes are...
I breathe a sigh of relief. She lets her razor slither into her hand. It goes rigid, and she turns my way. Slitted pupils drink in the light.
Your friends are in the lagoon. They hid there because our infrared is blinded by the pool's heat. A desperate last attempt. The air filtration systems on their helmets will have short-circuited from the EMP, so all they'll have is the air in their helmets. Not much of it either. They won't last 15 minutes. Those who don't have helmets, perhaps 6 minutes. Soon they'll bob up like apples.
She smiles pleasantly.
I'm saving them for Carnos. He's inside finishing up the diversions. He's a pleasure to watch, isn't he?
Hot rain clatters on our armor. The only sound.
Why are you here, Andromedus, and not in your room?
Arja plays with her razor, slicing raindrops in half.
The Sovereign was very clear.
I have something you'll want, I repeat.
What I want is for Octavia to be obeyed. Fly back to your room, boy, and take a nice shower and fondle the rose we left in your bed. Drain your anger, or whatever this is, into her, and leave your oath whole. Do not raise a finger against me. You have killed Greys only. That is easily forgotten, yes? Return, and she will think this only a flight of youth. Stay, and I will add your corpse and those of your bronzy friends to the heap.
The howlers bristle behind me. As you killed the servants, I ask heatedly, like goats for slaughter. Arja turns back to the pool.
It's time you left, Reaper. You're disgusting.
I step closer to her. All this power, and this is how you use it? Killing families in the middle of the gory damn night? Base fact is, you're a disgrace. I hope you remember the pain you brought others when I stand over your corpse. She turns on me in all her fury, razor snapping out, eyes gleaming. But she can't touch me. Not now. Not this night.
Darrow,
Severo calls with a sudden, odd pleasantness to his voice. Yes, Severo.
All that talk about remembering, aren't you forgetting something right now?
I think he is,
Quinn agrees.
A wise,
but forgetful Reaper,
finishes Clown in a very frivolous fashion.
Apologies, Aja. I forgot what I even came here to tell you.
I stand there looking flummoxed. Quinn sighs.
The bag. Oh, yes! Thank you for reminding me, Severo,
I cry theatrically. Aja doesn't know what the hell to make of this sudden banter.
Tell Weed to get down here.
Severo speaks into his comm, and a moment later Weed disengages his ghost cloak and flies from the wall a kilometer distant. We watch him approach. Pebble whistles a merry tune, earning a scowl from Harpy and a chuckle from Severo, who picks it up as well. The Praetorians think they are insane. Wolf pelts hanging from their backs, black custom armor, wolf helmets, and no one over 2 meters except for Quinn and me. It's like a violet traveling circus.
What are you playing at?
Aja demands.
Has no one ever bartered with you?
I ask, surprised.
More's the pity.
Weed lands in front of me and hands me the bag Severo gave me as a present.
Aja asks what's in the bag.
Order your men in the villa to stop the killing, and I will tell you.
I don't negotiate with boys,
Aja says. I nudge the bag lightly with my boot, showing Aja that whatever is inside is alive. She frowns, and perhaps she begins to understand what it is. She speaks in her comm for her men to stand down.
What's in the gory damn bag?
I open it up and pull out the heir to the morning throne like he's a freshly caught rabbit. Lysander's hands and feet are bound gently, and a silk scarf has been tied over his mouth to keep him from making noise. I untie it.
Hello, Aja, he says.
Aja lunges at him. I pull him backward.
Ah!
I hold my razor to the boy's neck, letting it curl around, just as the affectionate oracle wrapped itself around my wrist. Aja freezes. Her Praetorians watch quietly, black helmets and purple capes making them shadows. The few Bellona take steps forward. Aja motions them back.
Next person that moves, I cut them down. How did they get you, Lysander? Your guards?
It was Mustang, he says. Came to say hello. Cut open my window and gave me to the howlers.
Have you been hurt?
Your turn to speak is at an end, Aja, I interrupt. You will let my house members rise from the pool. You will let them board the shuttle I have inbound. You will tell the Ripwings and fighters in the sky and space above Luna to let us pass, or I will have my howlers kill the boy.
You promised to protect the Sovereign, Aja whispers, and you do this. He's a boy. He's helpless.
It's part of the game, Lysander says very seriously. You play it too, Aja. We're all on the board.
You see, he's less helpless than the servants you slaughtered tonight,
Quinn replies.
Less than those your father burned on Rhea. But he's one of yours. So, of course, you care.
You would kill a family to ensure the safety of your sovereign,
I say coldly. I would kill a child to ensure the safety of my friends. Speak again, and I take his left hand. She knows I would kill the boy. I know I would not. I'm not Carnus, not Evie or Harmony, despite what I'd have these golds think. So even if they called my bluff, I would balk. Anyway, the moment I kill him, they kill everyone I know. The murder would be in vain. This is exactly why I build my reputation as a killer, to leverage in situations like these. If they knew my heart, they'd kill my friends one by one. This is a gamble. I gamble on pride of two sorts. The first pride is that the Sovereign will not let me kill her only grandson, whom she trained from childhood to take her place when the time comes. The second sort of pride is that, deep down, she will believe it no great loss if Augustus and his family escape today. She has the will and the means to hunt us to the ends of the system. Why call my bluff and risk having her grandson die? I know this because of how she killed her father, not outright, but only when she had the support of all his former followers, only when they asked her to rise up against the tall tyrant and rule in his stead. A woman like her has patience. If the Sovereign told me to do my worst, if she shouted to kill the boy and suffer the consequences, that would be foolhardy. A blunt, brutish demonstration of power, as if saying, "Take my grandson, you cannot hurt me." No, instead she will feign weakness. Let me have this victory, and then bring eternal ruin on me and mine. Fair enough. We'll play that game another day. A ship roars overhead. A stork, built to deploy men and star shells to drop points, but slower than molasses sliding uphill. The bay doors open 200 meters up, as I instructed. So long as we have the boy, the ship's speed doesn't matter a lick. Of course, Mustang planned that. "We're going to fetch our people now, Aja. Let your men know they're to do nothing to impede us." Aja just stares at me, watching like a taunted panther in a zoo, eyes silent, horrible, as if willing the bars between us to disappear. "Severo, Thistle, check the villa. See if anyone managed to survive." They shoot away. "Quinn, guard the boy. The rest of you, get the Arch-Governor and his retinue out of the pool." "You'll want to call off the Ripwings," I say to Aja. They blink in the darkness kilometers above. "Too much noise and this whole thing will turn into a nightmare for all of us. The Sovereign massacring a house, but the house escapes. What a dastardly testament to her hunger, her impotence. What a debacle that might cause." I smirk at her. "Why, I fear some houses might rally around the offended house. Some may fear they too will be snuffed out like candles in the night. What would happen to the poor Pax Solaris then?" Quinn stays with me, fingers twitching toward her weapons as Aja obeys my commands. I keep my hand on the boy as the other howlers splash into the water and emerge with members of House Augustus clinging to them, soaked and gasping for air. Some in formal wear, some in armor, most without helmets. They were sharing oxygen, it seems. Augustus holds on to Harpy's back. The jackal holds on to Clown's arm. Pliny hangs on to his feet. Where are my friends? The howlers deposit the survivors into the bay of the hovering stork, high above, and return to fetch the rest. Victra is the next they bring out. She's helmetless and wounded on her neck, but she clings to her razor as though it were the thing carrying her aloft. Her eyes strafe the gathered Praetorians wrathfully, and when they find me, they spark against mine like bits of flint. Her anger falls away for a moment, and I see a smile of joy
Then it's gone, and she shouts, "I will remember you all with great joy." She laughs madly. "Starting with you, Aja Algrimus, I will make a coat of your hide." She disappears into the belly of the craft overhead. Roke is the next one borne aloft. Theodora is with him. I say a quiet prayer of thanks. Quinn touches my shoulder and gives him a wave. His thin face bursts into a smile at the sight of her. He doesn't even notice me. Then he's gone too, landing in the back of the ship. Thistle soon joins us from the manor, helping along several survivors, including the Telemannuses and Tactus, who bleeds from a dozen holes in his gold armour. He put up a nasty fight.
"Darrow!" he cries. "You mad bastard!"
He sees the Sovereign's son and cackles gleefully.
"Oh, that's ripe! That's ripe! I owe you a drink, my good man."
His voice fades away as he slips higher in the sky, though he managed to throw his fingers into the crux and wave them in Aja's direction.
"Tactus," Lysander whispers. "He's taller than in Hollows."
"That's the last of them," Severo says to me. "Tell your master we of Mars do not bow so easily," I say to Aja. The rain beats down between us, dripping over her dark face so her eerie eyes blaze in the night. She breaks the silence I imposed on her.
"That is what the governor of Rhea said when my Ash Lord came to put down his rebellion."
Her voice does not sound like her own. It's as though someone speaks through her.
"He looked at the thin man I sent with the armada, and he laughed, and asked why he should bow to me, the bitch patricide of a dead tyrant."
The Sovereign is speaking in Aja's ear, through her calm, with Aja repeating the words. My blood runs cold.
"The governor of Rhea sat upon his ice throne in his famed glass palace and asked one of my servants, 'Who are you to breathe fear into a man such as I? I who have descended from the family that carved heaven from a place where once there was nothing but a hell of ice and stone. Who are you to make me bow?' Then he struck the Ash Lord here under the eye with his scepter. 'Go home to Luna. Go home to the core. The outer reach is for creatures of sterner spines.' The governor of Rhea did not bow. Now his moon is ash. His family is ash. He is ash. So run, Darrow Au Andromedus. Run home to Mars, for my legions will follow you to the ends of this universe.'
'I hope so,' I say.
'You have one bargaining chip,'
the Sovereign, through Aja, reminds me.
'My grandson is your safe passage. If he dies, I wipe your ship from the sky. Spend him wisely.'"
Why is she telling me something I already know? "It's time to go, Darrow." Quinn leans into my shoulder. She sets a hand on my low back as if to remind me I am not alone. I nod to her. She covers my retreat as I rise upward with the boy, razor slithering around his neck. Quinn eyes the Praetorians warily and rises to follow. "I have one bargaining chip." What did the Sovereign mean by that? Was she reminding me that I could spend it only once? Only kill Lysander if my back was to the wall? Then I see why, as Aja looks at Quinn rising from the ground as a cat looks at a mouse.
"Aja, no!"
Lysander yells.
Quinn! I shout. In a flash, Aja lunges forward, quicker than any cat ever born. She grabs Quinn's hair. Frantically, Quinn brings her razor around to fend the giant woman off, but she's too slow. Aja slams her head into the ground with her left hand, punches her temple, armored fist on bone. 4 times before I can even blink. Quinn's legs kick and twitch and she curls inward like a dying spider, contorting from seizures. Aja backs away, watching me with a smile. Chapter 19. Stork. They know I am rash. Quinn is bait. Aja is the hook. They'll take Lysander if I buys an attack, Aja. They'll use the split second my razor's away from him to stun or kill me. I hear the weapons primed behind me, so I keep the razor to the little boy's throat. Tears distort my vision as I float there impotently. I shake my head as the agony wells. I can't leave her. Reversing my boots, I return to pick her from the ground. But before I can reach her, another gold flashes past me, descending from above, this one without armor, to scoop her from the ground and bear her aloft. The jackal. I shoot up and away, through the rain, into the bay doors, and land inside the stork. My boots clank on the metal deck and I kneel, shoving Lysander forward into the bay toward Severo. The boy sprawls to his knees. Several dozen dripping Augustans stare at me. They turn their eyes to the boy. The jackal follows, clutching Quinn awkwardly with one arm. Our ship rises and the doors hiss closed behind us. Roke pushes through the others to see me. Then his eyes go to the jackal. To Quinn, strength slipping from him with each second. The jackal sets Quinn gently on the ground and kicks off the ill-fitting grav boots he borrowed from one of the howlers. Roke's mouth works. No sound comes out. Is she? He murmurs finally. Are there any yellows on board? The jackal asks me. I look to Harpy. I point Harpy toward the main cabins. Find Mustang. Ask her. She sprints off. The medkit, the jackal snaps, feeling Quinn's pulse. He checks her pupils. No one moves. Now! Roke stumbles up to find it. Pebble rips it off the wall and tosses him the kit. He brings it back to the jackal. Mind turned to static, I stare down at Quinn, as another seizure racks her body, and an inhuman sound rattles from her nose and mouth. Roke's face is bloodless beside me. His hands reach helplessly for the girl he loves, as though his will alone can mend what was broken. But inside he knows he is powerless. He sinks to his knees. The jackal opens the med kit and rifles through its contents. His single hand moves confidently over the devices inside till they find a silver bar no larger than my index finger. He snatches it and activates the device. It hums softly, emitting a faint blue light. I need someone's data pad. Mine was fried in the EMP. No one moves. The girl will die. A gory damn data pad, now! I hand him mine. He doesn't look up at me, though he pauses a second when he sees my distinctive hands. Thank you for the rescue, Reaper, he says hastily. Thank your sister. Lysander rises and comes to my side. He watches quietly, no tears in his eyes. Pebble and Clan sit on their heels. No one touches Roke, though they glance at him, hands clutched on knees or razors, whispering whatever prayers to Luck Gold's whisper. The jackal moves the silver magnetic resonance imager over Quinn's head, watching the hologram on my datapad. He curses. What is it? Roke asks. The jackal hesitates. Her brain is swelling. If we can't control the pressure, we have a problem,
He fumbles with the medical equipment and unwinds a machine with a transparent cord. That pressure will deprive the brain of proper blood flow. It will starve itself as the vessels tighten under the swelling. Is she going to die? I ask. Not from swelling, the jackal says. Not if I can drain the fluid and release the pressure as it builds. But we'll need to get her head tilted so the blood can flow through the neck veins. Keep blood pressure steady. Get her a supply of O2. He looks up. So thin and wet, I'd think him a red instead of a gold, were it not for the dusty hair. Pebble, isn't it? Find her oxygen. A breathing mask will do, so long as it doesn't cover her face past her forehead. Pebble slips away. A fresh seizure contorts Quinn's body. I look on helplessly, and set my hand on Roke's shoulder. He flinches against the touch. Harpy slides back into the room. No slagging yellows. Shit, Clan swears. Shit, 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 shit. He kicks the wall. The jackal pauses, glances at Roke, then acts. He points to Clown, Harpy, and several house members. I need someone for each of her arms and her head. She's going to keep seizing, and for some reason, I suspect this is going to be a bumpy ride. We're going to move her out of this damn bay and hold her down for the surgery. He pulls her hair back into a ponytail, asks me to hold it, and pulls a small ionizer from the medkit. He squeezes it with his teeth over his hand, wincing as it destroys bacteria and dry skin follicles. Clown, get her hair. All of it. The jackal stands and tosses the ionizer to Clown, who bends and is about to scan it over Quinn's golden hair when Roke takes it from his grasp. He hovers over Quinn, unable to move. What's her name? The jackal asks Roke. Quinn. Talk to her. Tell her a story. Trembling slightly, Roke sniffs and speaks quietly to Quinn. Once, in the days of old Earth, there were two pigeons who were greatly in love. He toggles the ionizer and moves his hand. It is intimate, like he's bathing her. Just the two of them in some far-off place. Long before she told stories by the campfires of the Institute. Long before the horror. I smell hair burning as the jackal stands and comes to me. What happened down there? He asks. Was it a pulse fist? I look at him in surprise. You didn't see? Aja used her hands. Gory hell! His jaw tightens, dull eyes taking in the scene. How did we come to this? Octavia was set on this path all along, I say quietly. Before we even came to Mars, she intended to give the Bellona the Arch Governorship. The gala was a trap. When did you discover this? Before or after the jewel? Before, I lie. Well played. Makes us seem the victim. I see Mustang failed in her task. Did your father send her to infiltrate Octavia's court? No. I imagine it was her own idea. Draw close to the dragon. The Julii are against us too. He nods thoughtfully. Makes sense. Politicos tried to take Victor from us before Karnas and Aja came. You don't seem worried. Victor is her mother's favorite daughter. He shakes his head, remembering something. But she took 3 obsidians on for me. 3. She's with us, body and mind. I watch Roke finish removing Quinn's hair. Will she live? I ask quietly. She has bone fragments in her brain tissue. Even if we stop the swelling, she's hemorrhaging. Badly. We look down at Quinn. Her head bald now, face peaceful. Only small contusions on the side of her skull. You'd never guess she was dying inside. Roke strokes her forehead so gently, whispering soft things. Can you save her? I turned to the jackal. Is there a chance?
Not here. If you get us to a medbay, then yes, there's a prime chance.
Roke sings a soft song to her as they lift her body to move to another room. The song is one he made around the campfire as my army ate in the highlands. Quinn was with Cassius then, as it seems all women are at one time or another. But even then, I noticed her eyes met Roke's. They are the messenger pigeons from this story, crossing again and again in the sky. How excited he was to be reunited with her. I crack inside. I can still save her. I can fix this. The Sovereign was right. I misunderstood my own bargaining power. What was I going to do? Kill her grandson if Aja killed Quinn? What if she killed Severo, Mustang, Roke? I'm lucky she didn't hurt more of them. I turn to see Severo. He stands quietly in his armor watching us, watching Roke hold the girl Severo loves but has never told, the girl he could never have. The pain is raw and etched deep into the lines of his hawkish face. Impervious Severo, immune to hurt, to sadness, to having his eye gouged out by Lilith, the jackal's lieutenant. It all falls on him now. Quinn never called Severo goblin like the rest of us. Victra puts a hand on his shoulder, noticing the pain, if not understanding why it's there. He shoves her hand off. I don't know you, he snarls. Victra backs away. Sorry? What are you waiting for, Reap? He demands. We're not off this rock yet. He jerks his head. I follow, asking Victra to bring the Sovereign's boy. Severo and I climb a ladder and meet Tactus in the narrow corridor that leads to the passenger hold and the flight cabin. Oi, Goodman, Tactus calls, favouring his injured shoulder. Wet hair dangles over laughing eyes. His voice is loud, unmindful of Quinn's condition. Next time you're planning something dramatic, tell us you're coming so we don't go pissing our pants. I push past him. Not now, Tactus. Ever the bore. He eyes Severo. Looky, looky, goblin. If possible, you've shrunk even further, my good man. Severo doesn't smile. We enter the passenger hold, where the Augustans and Howlers buckle themselves into bucket seats in preparation for breaching the atmosphere. Tactus follows at our heels. Hello, psychos, Tactus calls to the Howlers. Pleasure to see your diminutive forms yet again. Especially you, Pebble. Eat shit, Pebble says, looking up from helping buckle one of Augustus's young nephews into his seat. Tactus leans into me when we're past the passenger hold. Good friends to come and rescue you. Thought they were scattered to the rim. Were, Severo says. What brought you back? Tactus asks. The weather? Severo says nothing. Tactus laughs despite the numerous holes in his armor. Just how you like 'em, eh, Taro? Friends who will risk life and limb to always be in your shadow. He nudges me a bit too playfully, leaving faint smears of his blood on me. We come to the flight cabin's closed door. Tactus winces as he bumps a bulkhead with his shoulder. Severo trails behind him. How's the shoulder? I ask. Better than that girl's head back there. Quinn, wasn't it? The fast one from House Mars. Aja slagged her good. Pity. I'd have taken her for up. Severo kicks Tactus in the balls from behind, foot going between legs hard enough to dent metal. He elbows him in the side of the head, sweeps his legs in swift cravat form. Three more strikes to the ears before Tactus hits the ground.
Severa puts one knee into Tactus's shoulder wound, a forearm against Tactus's throat, the other knee to Tactus's groin, and his free hand dangles a knife over Tactus's eyeball.
"Talk about Quinn again, and I'll cut your balls off and jam them in your eye sockets."
"Brother always said, keep your eye on the ball,"
Tactus gags out. The metal cabin door hisses open. Augustus fills the frame. He stares down at the scene just as Victor brings Lysander forward from the aft of the ship. "They're almost done, my liege," I say. I step over Tactus and Severo to join the arch-governor in the cabin. Victor does the same, except she steps on Tactus, grinding her heels. "Prime work," she says to Severo.
"Slag off, cow."
"Who is the little one?" she asks me as we slip into the cabin and close the door. I tell her.
"The Rage Knight's son? Nasty little man. I don't think he likes me."
"Don't take it personally."
The cockpit is larger than my room in the Citadel's villa. An array of lights ring the pilot and co-pilot chairs. Mustang sits to the left, a blue pilot to the right. The blue is jacked into the ship. A blue light glows under the dermis of her left temple. Mustang flies, right hand in a holographic control prism, speaking quickly with the blue. At the curved viewport, Earth hovers. Augustus, Pliny, and comically stooped Kavax Au Telemanus discuss our options behind Mustang. It is quiet.
"Well done, Darrow," Augustus says, without looking back to me, "though you could have chosen a better ship."
Mustang interrupts. "What's going on back there? They said someone was hurt."
"Quinn is dying," I say. "We have to get her to a med bay, fast-like."
"Even when we hit orbit, we're 30 minutes from our fleet," Mustang says.
"Fly faster."
The ship trembles as Mustang and the blue push it hard.
"It was a good plan," Kavax says, beaming down at Mustang. "It was a good plan, Virginia, infiltrating the Sovereign's household, just like when you were a girl. The time you and Pax hid in the shrubbery to listen to your father's counsel. Except Pax was bigger than the shrub."
He booms a laugh that startles the quiet blue. Mustang reaches back to squeeze his forearm, hands smaller than his elbow. He preens like a hound with a pheasant in its jaws, looking around to see if we all noticed her compliment. She's got away with men bigger than bears. The love on the man's face makes Augustus's own disinterest monstrous. And even worse, thinking about the jackal killing this man's son makes me sick. Mustang spares me the slightest glance, her hair bound behind her head, the memory of a smile still creasing the corners of her lips, and it's like I've been punched in the heart. There's no smile for me, and the horse ring no longer graces her finger. There's silence for a long moment. Augustus turns to look at me.
"I assume Octavia attempted to bring you into her fold as well?"
"She attempted."
"Slag herself! Bet you told her to go slag herself, eh, boy?"
Kavax booms. He slaps my shoulder, knocking me into Victra.
"Sorry."
He's bent like a hothouse tree grown too small for its roof. Water drips from his red forked beard.
"Sorry,"
he repeats to Victra. "Actually, Lord Telemanus, I thought her off attempting. She manages to treat her lances with respect, unlike others." Augustus wastes no time with banter. "We'll amend that. I owe you a debt, Darrow, provided we make it to my fleet." "You owe it to Mustang and the Howlers as much as me," I say.
"What is a Howler?" he asks.
"My friends in the black armor. Severo's the leader."
Servro. That wretched little thing that was atop my lancer, yes?
The Arch-Governor raises an eyebrow.
Thought I recognized him. Fitchner's boy. His tone sits poorly with me.
The one that killed that Priam brat in the passage.
He's with us, my liege, loyal as my own hands. The door hisses open, and Severo and Tactus join us. We all turn to look. Severo recoils slightly.
What?
He challenges. Tactus scoots off to the side, away from Severo.
Does your loyalty lie with me or with your father, Severo?
Augustus asks.
What father? I'm a bastard's bastard.
Severo looks the Arch-Governor up and down skeptically.
And all due respect, my liege, I could give a cat's frozen piss about you two. Your daughter brought me from the Rim. My allegiance is to her. But above all, it's to Reaper. That's it.
Mind your manners, you little puppy!
Kavax growls.
You must be Pax's father. Sorry he went. He's a man I might have died for. But I see he got his good looks from his mother.
Kavax isn't sure if he's been insulted. Augustus observes this.
Darrow, I owe you an apology. You were right. Loyalty, it seems, can extend beyond the Institute. Now, Lysander.
Augustus glances out the shuttle's viewport. We rise steadily. He kneels to speak with the boy.
I've heard tell that you are an exceptional lad.
I am, my liege,
Lysander says as firmly as he can.
They test me regularly, and I train in all manners of studies. I rarely lose in chess, and when I do, I learn as I ought.
Do you now? I had a son like you once, Lysander, but I'm sure you knew that.
Adrius our Augustus,
Lysander says, knowing the lineage.
No. Augustus shakes his head. No, my younger son isn't like you at all.
The boy frowns.
Then the elder, Claudius our Augustus.
Mustang glances back.
Yes, Augustus nods. A kind, special boy with a lion's heart. Better than me, kinder, a ruler.
He spares a strange, meaningful glance at me.
You would have been friends.
Lysander tries to look dignified.
What happened to him?
They left that part out, eh?
Well,
a large young man from the house Bellona, by the name of Carnus, took liberties with a certain young woman my son was courting. My son took umbrage and challenged Carnus to a duel. In the end, when my boy was broken and bleeding, Carnus kneeled, cupped my son's head.
He puts one hand around Lysander's head.
And smashed it on the cobbled stones till it broke open and all his specialness dripped out.
He pats the boy on the cheek.
Let's hope you never have to see such a thing.
Is that your plan for me, my liege?
Lysander asks bravely.
I'm only a monster when it is practical.
Augustus smiles.
I don't think I will have to be this time. You see, we're just trying to get home.
So long as your grandmother permits our passage, then you will be safe.
Grandmother says you're a liar.
Ironic.
You will tell her we've treated you well, I hope. If I am well treated. Fair enough.
Augustus touches the boy's shoulder and stands.
Victor, take him to the passenger hold.
Victor glowers. Of course Augustus chooses the only woman but Mustang.
Tactus notices her reaction and steps forward.
Might I, my liege?
I've not seen my own brothers in some time. I wouldn't mind talking with the lad.
Augustus nods as if to say he doesn't care. Victra thanks Tactus, surprised by his gesture. He winks at her, punches my shoulder, and pats Lysander roughly on the head, almost knocking him down.
I'd hate to know his brothers.
Come, tiny one, tell me, have you ever been to a pearl club?
He asks, leading him away.
The girls and boys there are spectacular.
The ponderous stork climbs higher and higher. In 2 minutes, we'll hit the edge of the atmosphere.
They tried to kill me as I slept, Augustus murmurs. She knows I will not forgive this.
She'll come to Mars, I say.
Is there no chance for amends to be made?
Pliny asks.
Amends? Mustang snarls. Make amends with the woman who burned a moon, Pliny. Are you an idiot?
Peace will preserve your line, my liege, more than war. Set yourself against the sovereign, and what hope can there be?
Pliny is no fool with rhetoric. Her fleets are vast, her money's endless. Your name, your honour, no matter how great, cannot stand beneath the weight of the society. My liege, you raised me to your side because of my worth, because you trusted my advice. Without you, I am nothing. Your care is all I value. So heed my advice now, if you still hold it in regard, and do not let this wound against the sovereign fester. Do not let war come of this. Remember Rhea, yes, and how it burned. Preserve your honoured family with peace by any means.
Augustus raises his voice. When the sovereign pushed against me, I bent like Goal should, with grace, with dignity. But now she cuts at me, and beneath the grace, beneath the aplomb, a knife will strike iron. We make for Mars, and for war.
We're reaching the low atmosphere, Mustang says. Hold on.
What is that light? Severo asks.
The blinking one, over the altimeter.
The blue snaps an answer.
The cargo bay door is opening, Dominus.
The cargo bay?
I frown.
Can you override it?
No, Dominus. I'm locked out.
Why would the cargo bay door be...
He volunteered, Mustang says, voice panicked. Tactus volunteered.
No,
I snarl, startling everyone but Mustang. We realized it at the same time.
Severo, Victor, on me!
I wheel around and sprint out of the cabin doors, head ducked as I move as fast as I can toward the back of the ship.
Prepare for evasive action,
I hear Mustang say back in the cabin.
What's happening?
Pliny whines.
Tactus!
I bellow. Victor and Severo run at my heels. The other howlers and house members call to me, confused as I sprint through the passenger bay. Screwface unbuckles his crash belt. He went past with the boy.
Down!
I say, shoving him in a seat.
Everyone stay seated!
Tactus wouldn't. He couldn't. But why the hell not? Why would I ever assume he wouldn't do what's best for him? It's in his nature.
We slide down railings to the storage level, past the room where the jackal operates on Quinn. I shove open the door to the cargo hold, and I'm greeted by the howling of wind. The hatch hangs open to show darkness wounded by city lights far beneath. Clown and an Augustus Lancer lie unconscious, bleeding. They slide slowly toward the open bay door. As for Tactus, he's nothing but a distant dot in the darkness. I cannot see him clearly, but I know what he has taken. Lysander.
Severo!
I grip my friend's shoulder.
Stop!
He's seething.
Looks like he wants to jump out of the back of the ship and follow Tactus into the air.
He can't. It's too late. Instead, we catch the two unconscious Golds before they slip down the open ramp. Victor shuts it at the control panel. The door hisses closed.
He doesn't have any communications gear, Victor says breathlessly. Not after the EMP.
Doesn't need the gory damn gear.
Several points to Clown's naked feet. The bastard has grav boots. As soon as he hits the ripwing scanners, he'll be picked up.
I do the math. We have 2 minutes till they send boarding parties.
Chapter 20. Helldiver. I should have known what Tactus would do. He killed his first Primus, Tamara, in the Institute. He only ever followed strength. Only ever sought victory. I knew he was a beast, but I thought he was my beast. I thought I could trust him. No, I thought I could change him. I curse myself. Arrogant fool. I stalk back to the cockpit, where Augustus addresses the blue pilot.
Pilot, will you be able to take us clear?
No, Dominus. Geomet models don't show a probability of escape.
Her response is fittingly blue, emotionally distant, efficient and declarative. Her body is thin, faintly avian, like she's made of all twigs, neck long, bald head slightly smaller, eyes large and as uncannily azure as the digital tattoos of her skull. When she moves, it's as though she's submerged in water. Asteroid-born, judging by her flat accent.
What is the likely scenario?
They will destroy our engines with ripwing fire, precipitating a hull breach that will kill all aboard. Alternatively, precipitating a leechcraft assault, capturing all aboard.
Or they'll just blast us from the gory sky.
Severo adds.
Blue, deliver me to my ship and you will receive command of a frigate.
Augustus offers.
I would prefer a cruiser,
she notes.
A cruiser, then.
Very well.
The blue adjusts several knobs.
I will fly well, but the paradigm must be altered before they engage our vessel, if we are to survive.
The stork climbs toward the edge of Luna's atmosphere. This ship is a big-bellied beast, fat with storage room, because all they're meant to do is birth soldiers out of the tubes in their guts. Men like me would tear her apart with our ripwings. We used ships like this at the Academy to launch men in star shells at enemy asteroid bases.
Friction fire wreathes the ship.
If the hull is breached, hold your breath, Domini, the pilot instructs. We don't have sufficient survival helmets aboard.
Victra frowns.
Our lungs will explode if we do that.
Then exhale, the blue replies, and have 30 secs of life while eardrums explode and blood vessels swell like inflated balloons. I will hold my breath.
Severo looks back at me, wide-eyed.
I hate space.
You hate everything.
We pop clear of Luna's atmosphere. The fire fades and we slip into open space, where the Armada's capital ships glide like behemoths of Europa's deep sea. Gun turrets dot their hides like barnacles, and hangar bays slice their undersides like great gills. Commercial ships float slowly along the shipping lanes. Rip wings and wasps go about their patrols. None pay heed to our presence except those that escort us from Luna. The Sovereign would not broadcast this.
Time ticks away. There is nowhere to flee. We thought to pass just under the guns of the Scepter Armada when we had Lysander, but now we'll have to run the gauntlet. Our pilot is calm as metal. She said the paradigm must change.
What can I do? Think. Think.
We will open communications to one of the ships, Augustus says. Bribe them into sheltering us. Every man has a price.
We're jammed,
Can't even broadcast.
Mustang reminds him. We're going to die. We all know it. Augustus doesn't panic or surrender resolve. I don't know how I thought he'd handle death. Maybe I hoped he would wail about and turn pale. But for all his faults, he is stalwart. After a moment, he sets a bony hand on Mustang's shoulder. She flinches, surprised. Whether missile or boarding craft come, die like golds, Augustus says solemnly to us. Not because he wishes us to think him strong in his last moments, but because he believes in what he is. A superior being. A master of his human frailties. For him, death is merely the ultimate frailty. Humans whimper when they die. They claw for life even if there is no hope. He will not. Death is not grander than his pride. Golds, in many ways, are so like reds. Helldivers go to their deaths for their families, for the pride of their clan. They do not whimper when the mines collapse around them, or when the pit vipers come from the shadows. They fall, and their friends weep and sweep their bodies aside. But we have the veil to look forward to. What of the golds? When they perish, their flesh withers, and their name and deeds linger till time sweeps them away, and that is all. If anyone should claw for life now, it should be the Oriot. I claw because I carry the torch of something that must not die, must not go out. That is why I grab Severo on the shoulder and, with a horrible, eerie laugh, tell the pilot to take us closer to the deadliest ship in orbit, one which now has angled itself to intercept us. Take us near the Vanguard, I repeat to the Blue. That would cause our chances of survival to decrease by... Never tell me the odds, just do it, I command. Everyone turns and looks at me. Not because I've said something strange, but because they've been waiting to turn and look at me. They've all been silently praying I would marshal a plan, even Augustus. Io said people would always look to me. She believed I had some quality, some essence that gave hope. I rarely feel it in myself. There is none in me now, just dread. Inside I feel such a boy, angry, petulant, selfish, guilty, sad, alone. And yet they look to me. I almost break underneath their gaze, almost wither away and ask someone else to take the reins. I can't do it. I'm small. I'm just a liar in a carved body. But that dream must not be extinguished. So I act, and they watch.
You gone space mad? Victra asks. When they realize we don't have the boy...
Draw an angle toward the Vanguard's bridge, Mustang tells the Blue. Augustus gives me a curt nod, guessing what I plan. Hic sunt leones. Hic sunt leones, I echo, saving my last look for Mustang, not the man who hanged my wife. She doesn't notice. I leave the bridge with Severo at a dead sprint. Something hits our ship. Her hull shudders. They know we don't have Lysander.
Howlers! Get up! I shout.
Harpy throws up her hands.
I thought you said...
Up! I roar.
Red secondary lights bathe the launch bay in bloody hues as Severo and I load ourselves into the cold star shells. It takes two howlers each to help us slip into the robotic carapaces. I lie in the armor as Harpy buckles my feet into the stirrups and closes the armored legs over my meat and bones. The howlers are fast in their movements, even as the ship lurches with another near-missile strike. A siren howls, reporting a hull breach. I try to slow my breath as Victra fits my head into the starshell's helmet.
Good luck.
She leans her face close. Before I can stop her, she presses her lips to mine. I do not recoil. Not this close to death. I let her lips part and cling warm and comforting around mine. Then the human moment is over and she's gone, lowering the massive visor of my helmet. My howlers howl and hoot at the sight. I can't help but wish it was Mustang who sealed me in this tin can and kissed me goodbye. But then the digital display owns my vision, and I disappear from my friends into the metal launch tube. I'm alone and scared. Focus. I'm cocooned, belly down in the spit tube. This is where most would piss themselves, separated from friends, from the warmth of life. There's no gravity in the tube. It isn't pressurized. I hate the weightlessness of it. I can't look up or my neck will break when they launch me. I can't move side to side. My star shell is latched into 1,000 tooth-like magnetic hooks. They click into place like tiny insects, chattering. In moments, they'll shoot me into space. My breath rasps. My heart rattles against my sternum. I drink in my body's terror and smile. They said this was suicide at the academy when I wanted to launch myself. Maybe they were right. But this is why I was made. To dive into hell. I'm a beetle of a man in a carapace of metal, weapons and engines that cost more than most ships. I've got a pulse cannon on my right arm. When I need it, it will bloom like a hemanthus blossom. I think of the time Io laid a hemanthus before my front door, the time I plucked one from the wall on the night that I was supposed to win the laurel. How far away those warm days seem from this cold place, where petals are metal instead of soft like silk.
We're getting pinned in. Boarding party's imminent.
Mustang's voice comes over the comm.
Priming your launch.
The ship moans as another missile almost claims us. Our shields are shot, just the rickety hull holding us together.
Aim true, I say.
Always. Darrow.
Her silence says 1,000 things. I'm sorry, I tell her.
Good luck.
This is not fun, Severo groans.
The ship's hydraulic system hisses and the metal teeth jerk me forward in the tube, loading me into the chamber. Inches before my head, the magnetic stream of the railgun hums dreadfully, daring me to glance its way. They say that many gulls can't take this, that even Peerless can panic and scream and cry in the spit tube. I believe it. Pixies would have heart attacks right now. Some cannot even ride in a spaceship for fear of small places and the vastness of space. Soft-bellied fools. I was born in a home smaller than the cargo bay of this ship. I made my life at the end of a claw drill that makes this tube look like a child's toy, all while sweating and pissing my soul away in a fry suit cobbled together from scrap. Still, there's the terror.
Watch how a pit viper strikes, my son.
Father once clutched me by my wrist and made me play this game.
Watch it coil upward and upward till it reaches its crest. Don't move before then. Don't strike out with your sling blade. If you do, then it'll get you. It'll kill you. Move just when it's coming down. Do that with the terror in life. Don't act till you're as scared as you'll get. Then...
He snapped his fingers. I'm at that point when the music of the machines takes hold. The clicks and the clacks, the hisses and the hums reverberate through the hull. A countdown begins.
Ready over there, Goblin? I ask Severo over the comm. Cacatni ursus in silvus?
Does a bear shit in the woods?
The ship spins and shudders. More sirens howl. Latin now. Ordentes fortuna juvat.
Severo chuckles.
Fortune favours the bold. You deserve to die if that's really going to be the last thing you say in this life. Yes? Well, you may suck my...
My heart sticks to its downward beat. The metal teeth jerk me forward into the tube's magnetic stream. And it happens. Even through my suit, G-forces hit me like the backhand of the Obsidian's thunder god. My vision flickers black. Stomach rises into throat. Lungs constrict. Blood slows in my veins. I snap forward. Lights flicker in my eyes. I don't see the walls of the tube I'm shot through. I don't even see the ship that brought me here. I see Io's face in the darkness. I black out. Bodies can't take this. Too fast. Darkness. Then the darkness has holes. Stars. There's no meantime. 1 second I'm on the ship. The next I'm ripping through the deep of space at 10 times the speed of sound. Many shit their suits at this point. It's not a fear thing. It's biology and physics. The human body can only take so much. Mickey the Carver made sure mine could take just a little bit more. I hope Severo's can too. I rip soundlessly through space. Trust that Severo is near me. Can't see him, even on the sensors. All too fast. Toward the greatest ship in the Scepter Armada, the one we should avoid. It all happens in 6 seconds. Emergency missiles streak past us. The gunners see us now, know what's happening, but we're not using thrusters so the missiles can't lock. Flak can't detonate on so short a fuse. The unspent canisters fly past us, nearly hitting me. Our pilot took a perfect shot. Railguns miss us. Projectiles flash past. Severo is howling in the comm. Their shields are down. They can't bring them up fast enough. It takes time. Iridescent blue flickers over their hull as the pulse shields power up. Too late, you sons of bitches! Too bloody damn late! I can't think. I'm screaming inside, laughing like the flames of a wildfire, laughing because I know it is my madness that these logical warriors can't fight. The bridge is close. I spare a look up, see golds inside roaring at one another, rushing to their evac suits or escape pods, staring at us approaching like Mustang did when my horses of House Mars crashed into her and Pax in a muddy field. A rage is something unique, something these loon-born don't understand. Blues scatter. Obsidians pull their weapons. 2 golds don breath masks and unfurl razors, ready for the kill. The second before we hit, I shoot my pulse cannon. It thumps on the thick glass. I shoot again and again and again. Then I curl into a ball and smash into the thick bridge glass with the full velocity of my launch, as well as a last-second burst from my thruster boots. Out of me roars a madman's scream. Chapter 21. Stains. I explode through the bridge like a ball of lead shot into a store of china and glass. I crash into displays and strategy desks before blasting through the reinforced metal of the bridge walls, through the steel of the hallways, till at last I slam bodily into a bulkhead 100 meters through and past the bridge. Dazed. Can't find Severo. I call him over the comm. He groans something about his ass. Maybe he did shit himself. We can't hear it because of our helmets, but the ship is filled with howling as the vacuum of space sucks crew members to their deaths. It really doesn't suck them out through the shattered windows so much as the internal pressure of the ship pushes them out. Either way, blues and oranges and golds fly screaming into space. The obsidians go silently. Not that it matters. Space makes all silent in the end. My left arm spits sparks. My pulse cannon is shredded. Inside the suit, my arm hurts like hell. I have a concussion. I puke inside my helmet. Fills it with a bitter stench. Stings the nostrils. But I keep my feet, and my right arm works well enough. View shield is cracked. I stumble as I'm sucked toward the bridge, too. I crawl back through the holes I made in the walls, make it to the bridge to find the place in chaos. Crew members hold onto anything to prevent themselves from being sucked into the cold darkness. A gold girl flips past me and flies out the bulkhead. Finally, red lights flash. Emergency bulkheads slam shut all over this part of the ship to cut the pressure leak. One begins to close behind me, reinforcing a wall that I crashed through. I hold it up when I see Severo coming. The metal groans against the robotic arm of my starshell. Severo dives through just in time, and the door slams shut. Bridge is locked down, with us inside. Perfect. The pressure wind dies behind us as the durosteel slats slide over the demolished viewports. The ship's officers and crew pick themselves up from the ground, gasping for breath. But there is none. Oxygen and pressure are still being pumped back into the room. So those with breathing masks, the golds, obsidians and blues, watch placidly as the few pink valets and orange technicians on the bridge flop like fish, gasping for air that is not there. One pink vomits blood, his lungs exploding in his chest because he tried to hold his breath. The blues watched the deaths in horror. They have never seen men die. They're used to seeing blips on the scanners disappearing, perhaps a distant ship exploding or gouting flame as it is boarded by obsidians and greys. Their understanding of the mortal coil is being adjusted. The obsidians and the gulls don't react to the scene. Some of the greys attempt to administer aid, but it is too late. By the time the pressure and oxygen levels are normalized, the low colors are dead. I'll never forget those faces. I brought them this. How many families will weep because of what I did here? In anger, I stomp my metal boot on the steel deck. 3 times. And those who did nothing while their allies died turn to see Severo and me in our killing suits. Oh, how those gold and obsidian faces finally emote. An obsidian charges us with a force spike. Severo hits him once, crushing the man's face with a metal fist. The other 4 link together and attack us, keening one of their hideous war chants. Severo meets them, delighted to finally be the biggest in the room. I engage a squad of greys who scramble for their weapons. This is the way it goes. We're men of metal, fighting disorganized men of flesh. Like steel fists punching the inside of a watermelon. I've never killed men with so little regard, and it frightens me how easy I find it in war. There is no ambiguity here, no violation of moral creed. These people are war colours. They kill me, or I kill them. It's simpler than the passage. Simpler that I don't know them, that I don't know their brothers and sisters, that I use metal instead of my own flesh to drive them through death's dark door. I am good at it. Better by worlds than Severo. And that terrifies me above all else. I am the Reaper. Whatever doubts I had in myself fall away as I feel the stain creeping over my soul. We do our best to save the blues. The bridge is large, but there aren't many obsidians or greys with projectile and energy weapons. No reason for them here. No one has ever come through the viewports. 2 female gulls with razors are the true menace. One is tall and broad, the other has a quick face that is pinched with desperation as she charges us. With their razors, they could even cut our suits in half, so Severo blasts them from a distance with his pulse cannon, overloading their aegises and splashing the energy onto armor where it overloads the pulse shields and eats into the armor, melting the gulls. This is why they control technology. Humans, no matter their color, are fragile as doves in the meat grinder of war. My enemy's dead. I turn now to the blues in the pits. Is there a captain? I ask. In my suit, I stand nearly a meter taller than them. They're still staring at the mess we made of the others. I must be a walking nightmare. Arms spitting sparks, suit half-ruined, holding a terrible razor.
I don't have all day to threaten and stomp. You are erudite men and women. This is not your ship. You merely occupy it for the gold who commands it. I now command it. So, is there a blue captain about?
The captain survived. He's a placid, clean-looking man, more limbs than torso, with a fresh gash on his face that pains him terribly. He trembles and sniffles, holding the wound as though his face would fall apart were his hands to leave it. Mother would have called him a shit-eating ninny, Pris. Io would have taken a different tack, so I stand over him and speak quietly. "You are safe," I say. "Do not attempt anything rash." I pop my helmet. The sick drips out. I tell him he's to go to the corner and strip off his star badge of rank. Trembling, he doesn't get a chance to obey. Severo lurches forward, takes his badge and picks him up and moves him like a doll. A long-faced, proud-shouldered woman with deep olive skin snorts at the demotion. Her gaze is peculiarly shrewd for a blue. Bald, like the rest, with digital azure tattoos swirling not only along crown and temples, but over hands and neck. Severo lopes back to me.
Severo, stop pissing around.
I like being big.
I'm still bigger.
He tries flipping me the crux in his suit, but the mechanical fingers aren't so agile. I give orders to the blues in the tech pits that our friends in the Stork are to be given access to one of the hangar bays. After settling themselves back into their stations, they obey. All here are loyal because I have them under my power. But throughout the ship, who knows? They may be loyal to the Sovereign. Or they may only be loyal to the man who rules this ship. It'd be foolish to think they all operate under the same creed. I'll have to make them. I watch the Stork coast into a hangar bay on a display. She's barely held together by her bolts. Two leechcraft festoon her. My howlers will have to fight off the squads of killers they contained. They might manage, but if the vanguards, obsidians and greys besiege them in the hangar, then all is lost. Sounds come now from the bulkhead that connects the bridge with the rest of the ship. A deep spine hissing. The door glows red from heat. A small pupil in the centre of the thick grey durosteel. Obsidians, or grey marines, no doubt led by some gold, endeavour to reclaim the ship. Should take them a little while.
Is there a holocam in the hall? I ask the blues.
They hesitate.
Black space, you daft gas bags,
curses the female blue I noted before. She pushes another blue out of the way and syncs her tattoos with the console. A holo appears in one of the screens, confirming my fear. Golds lead the party, attempting to make their way onto the bridge.
Show me the engine room, the life support nexuses, and the hangar bay, I demand.
She does. Again, golds lead parties of grey marines and obsidian slave knights to secure the ship's vital systems. They'll try to wrest control of it away from me. Worse, they'll try to board or destroy the Stork to kill or capture Mustang and my friends.
Who wants this ship?
I ask severely. I stalk along the raised command podium, kicking aside a body in my way and looking down at the communications blues in their pit. They dodge my gaze, two women no older than I, faces pale and fresh, like morning snow, now stained with tear tracks and grime. Wide cerulean eyes, raw-rimmed and shot with red. They've seen friends die today. And here I rage selfishly, acting as though this is my triumph. It's so easy to lose myself. Never forget what I am, I remind myself. Never forget. We're being hailed by a dozen ships and the Citadel Ground Command. What's happened? They want to know. Torch ships and destroyers coast warily toward us. I open a closed-circuit comm channel to the whole of my ship.
Attention, crew of the vessel formerly known as the Vanguard, hereafter known as the Pax.
I pause dramatically, knowing that any good song, any good dance, is a game of tension leading to a climax of sound and movement. Severo can't stop grinning boyishly at me. He looks like an imp in the huge suit, head so small with his helmet off. He makes a big motion with his hands to try to make me laugh. I shake my head at him. Now isn't the time.
My name is Darrow Au Andromedus, Lancer of the Martian House Augustus, and I have claimed this vessel as the spoil of war. It is mine. This means, per societal rules of naval warfare, that your lives are mine. I am sorry for that, because it means you will likely all die. Your lives have been dedicated to one vocation or another: electronics, astral navigation, gunnery, janitorial service, lighting and repair, martial combat. My vocation is conquest. They teach us it in schools. And in school, they instructed me on the proper method of invading, seizing, and possessing an enemy warship. After one has captured the bridge of an enemy-held vessel, the procedure taught to us is simple. Vent the ship. Severo activates the hidden console secured in the back side of the navigation display. One only Golds can access. The Blues recoil in surprise. It is like going into a man's kitchen and showing him a nuclear bomb hidden under his sink. The console scans Severo's golden sigil and blinks gold. All he need do is push in a code, and the entire ship will open to space. 20,000 men and women will die. We made these ships so we could empty them. Why? Not because we distrust your loyalty, in fact, we rely on that, but because there are still... I look at the roster one of the Blues gives me. 61 Golds on board. They are loyal to the Sovereign. I am her enemy. They will not obey me. They will sabotage the ship, attempt to take the bridge. They will rally you, abuse your loyalty, and lead you to certain death. Because of them and their hatred of me, you will never see your loved ones again. There is yet another complication. Beyond this hull, the Sovereign wonders what happened here. Soon she will realize the pride of her armada no longer belongs to her. It is mine. Her praetor's ships will vomit out squadrons of leechcraft carrying legions of obsidians and grey marines. They will be led by gold knights who want my head, fully prepared to kill all in their path. If I vent you into space, there will be no one to stop them from killing me. So, you see, you are my salvation, and I am yours. I will not sacrifice 20,000 of you to kill 61 of my enemies. I chose this vessel above all others because of its crew, the best the society can offer. To me, you are not expendable. So what I ask of you is this: choose me as your commander, and overwhelm those Golds who think you expendable. You have my permission, my warrant, and the badge of the Arch-Governor of Mars, Nero Au Augustus, to capture or kill your Gold commanders for me. Take their weapons and subdue them, then make fast the ship against the invaders who come to destroy us. Do it now. If you wait, they will kill you. I will know the first men and women to rise up. As your new master, I will reward you. The Arch-Governor will reward you. Do it now, for I have just opened every armory throughout the ship.
Seize weapons and neutralize the tyrants.
A heavy silence as the first sparks of revolution are struck. Severo comes close.
That was rousing.
Too democratic, I whisper.
I don't think autocratic democracy counts.
Severo wrinkles his nose.
You did threaten to vent them into space.
Threaten? I thought I implied it rather smoothly.
Smooth as gravel, dipshit.
Severo cackles a bit too enthusiastically and slaps his leg with his mech hand, denting the metal there. He winces, then looks up at me slightly embarrassed.
Slag off!
The door behind us begins to hiss. I turn to look at the glowing bulkhead. My enemies have brought a drill to assail me. My hands shake from the adrenaline. I feel the weight of dozens of blue eyes. The red of the door deepens, spreading. We haven't long. My razor ripples into killing form, long and terrible. Company soon, I say. I glance at Severo, who has been distracted by one of the hollow screens. I order the blues to take shelter.
They're doing it, Severo murmurs. Gory hell. Taro, come look.
He cycles through live visuals of oranges and blues ransacking the armories. Some greys help them. Others stand by, unsure of their prerogative, even as others shoot at the tide of their fellow shipmates. But no bullets can hold back this tide. They take weapons, run sloppily through halls, swelling their ranks. The roughest lead, not blues, but orange hangar workers and mechanics, along with greys.
One I recognize.
The middle-aged corporal on my ship at the academy, the one who escaped with us. He directs a score of men and women into the stateroom of a gold. They subdue him respectfully. That peaceful accord is not far spread. Three powerful squads of gulls, leading obsidians and greys, marshal in the life support rooms at the engines 5 kilometers back to the aft of the ship and just outside the bridge door. Those outside the bridge door number 4 golds and 6 obsidians. 10 greys load weapons behind them.
We're still going to have company, I say.
They'll be coming through the door at any moment. Sparks spit from the inside of the bulkhead as their heat drill gets the better of the door. Metal drips inward, bubbling to the floor. The blues shiver in terror, and Severo and I square ourselves up and don our helmets, preparing for the new onslaught. Again, the stench of sick fills my nostrils. I tell the blues to hide in the communications bay. They'll be safe there. A comm light suddenly blinks on a console near me. Instinctively, I answer. A voice like thunder sends tremors through my bones. There is no visual.
Can you hear me?
It asks.
I can.
I glance over at Severo. Whoever calls is using a voice amplifier that sounds like the breaking of thunder. Severo shrugs as if he hasn't a clue who it is.
Who is this?
Are you a god?
A god?
An eerie quiet settles in me. That is no voice amplifier. I should have known by the cold, sluggish accent. I choose my words carefully, remembering my lore.
I am Daro Au Andromedus of the Sunborn.
You took the vessel and you are not yet praetor. How?
I flew in through the bridge.
Alone? From the abyss?
With a companion.
I will come to meet you and your companion, godchild.
The blues look to one another in terror. They mouth something.
Stained.
The heaviness of fear settles on my shoulders. Severo and I peer around the bridge as though the beast were hiding somewhere in the shadows. More of the door peels away, dripping inward like some glowing red, rotting fruit. Then one of the blues gasps, and we glance back at the HC monitor to see the cameras in the halls outside the bridge door relaying a scene of horror. He runs at them from behind as they prepare to make entry into the bridge. An obsidian, but larger than any I've ever seen. But it's not just his size. It's how he moves. A dread creature stitched from shadow and muscle and armor, flowing, not running. Perverse. Like looking at a blade or a weapon made flesh. This is a creature that dogs would flee, that cats would hiss at. One that should never exist on any level above the first tier of hell. He smashes into the kill squad from behind with two pulsing white iron blades that extend out of his armor 3 feet from his hands. The greys he simply runs through, crushing them into the walls with his shoulders, splintering their bones. Then he starts the real killing. It's so savage I have to look away. The heat drill continues melting the door of its own accord, and in its center forms a hole. Through it I can see men and women dying. Blood sizzles on the overheated metal. When the stain is done, he's bleeding from a dozen wounds, and there's only one gold left. She stabs him with a razor, piercing his dark armor through the breastplate. He twists his body, locking the blade in, and then clutching it when she lets the blade relax into a whip. Then he grabs her by her helmet, her golden armor glittering under the hall's lights. She tries to escape, tries to scramble away, but like a lion with a hyena in its jaws, he needs simply squeeze. When she is gone, he lays her gently on the ground. Tender now that he's brought her a good death. Severo involuntarily steps back from the door. Mother mercy! The stained stands on the other side, the door between us slowly melting from the center. When the hole in the door is the size of a torso, he removes his helmet. A hairless, pale face stares at me. Eyes black, wind-weathered cheeks armoured with calluses like the hide of a rhinoceros. Head bald except for a metre-long white shock of hair that hangs to his mid-back. We lock eyes, and he addresses me.
God child Andromedus, I am Ragnar Valaris, the stained firstborn of my mother, Alia Snowsparrow. Of the Valkyrie Spires, north of the Dragon's Spine, south of the Fallen City, where the Winged Horror flies. Brother of Sephi the Quiet, breaker of Thanos, which once stood by the water. And I make you an offering of stains.
He splays out his gigantic blood-stained hands, and then reaches through the door with his right hand. His iron blades retract into his armor. The razor still juts out from his ribs. I'm pissing my bloody damn suit.
Well, frag me blind, Severo mutters. Do it, Darrow, before it changes its mind.
Taking my helmet off, I step forward.
I want this one.
Ragnar Valaris, well met. I see you wear no badge. Do you have a master?
I bore the mark of the Ash Lord, and was to be presented as a gift with this great vessel to the family Julii. But you took this vessel, and so you have taken me.
The Julii?
A gift for their betrayal of Augustus, no doubt. And did he just use a bureaucratic loophole to justify killing his master's men? If there's irony in his voice, I can't find it. But why would he do that? Do those black eyes of his know me?
Stained cannot use tech other than military materiel. He could never have seen me before, yet his hand remains, waiting to grip mine.
Why do you do this?
I ask. Is it the Julii?
They trade my kind.
I had forgotten. It is Julii ships that carry obsidian slaves across the abyss. They know to fear the speared son of Victra's family crest. He is not practiced at hiding his hate. It is cold as the ice the man was born into.
Will you accept these stains, godchild?
He asks, leaning forward, voice plaintive, a strange worry creasing the corners of his mouth. Golds did this after the Dark Revolt, the only uprising to ever threaten their reign. We took their history, took their technology, wiped out a generation, and gave their race the poles of planets, the religion of the Norse, and told them we were their gods. A few hundred years later, I stand looking up at one of their most terrifying sons and wonder how he can think of me as a god.
I accept these stains in my name, Ragnar Valaris.
Terrified, I reach forward and, with superheated metal surrounding our arms, clasp hands, nearly equal in size, though mine is sheathed in metal. I take the blood that his hand spreads to mine and wipe it over my exposed brow.
I accept their burden and their weight. Thank you, Sunborn. Thank you. I will serve on the honor of my mother and her mother before her.
I have friends aboard the Stork in Hangar Bay 3. Save them, Ragnar, and I will owe you a debt.
Yellow teeth are revealed as he smiles, and from him undulates a war chant deeper than the ocean at storm. It fills the halls with dread, fills me with joy and fear and primal curiosity. What did I just gain?
Chapter 22. Fire Blossom. My body trembles in the aftermath of the giant's departure. Steadying myself, I turn back to the Blues, who stand transfixed, unsure whether to look at me or the HC displays or the scanners that show the Sovereign's men of war encircling us.
You have nothing to fear here, I say. The captain of this ship was demoted because he left his viewports open. Foolishly. Rank does not excuse mistakes. I wish for a new captain. We haven't much time, so I will decide in 60 seconds.
The proud-shouldered Blue comes forward past her fellows. At first, I thought the tattoos on her hands featured floral lines. Then I noticed a stream of mathematical notations. The Larmor formula. Maxwell's equations in curved space-time. Wheeler-Feynman absorber theory. And 100 others that even I don't recognize.
Give me the badge and I'll carve you a hole back to Mars, boy.
Her voice has no inflection. It is flat, precise and lazy all at once. Emotion bled out of it till only the letters and sounds of the words remain, like equations in the air.
I swear it on my life.
Boy, I ask.
You're half my age. Shall I call you Lord Boy, or will you be offended?
Severo raises an eyebrow, flummoxed at the Blue's bland audacity.
Forgive her, Dominus, another Blue says smoothly. She is an ensign with...
I hold up a hand. What's your name, Blue?
Orion Z. Aquarii.
That's a boy's name, Severo says. Is it? I hadn't noticed.
Blues can be sarcastic.
My sect intended for me to be a man. I surprised them. What sect? Severo asks.
She has no sect. She was appropriated by the Copernican sect, but dismissed shortly thereafter for obvious reasons.
That officious Blue interrupts again.
She's a docker.
Orion flinches. She swivels on the other Blue,
Her voice does not rise.
And what are you but a pedantic little gasp of a fart, Pelos? You see, Pelos explains placidly, she is a docker. Emotional metrics are unmanageable. Not her fault. She is a product of her greasy environment.
Bolly that, she says, stepping forward quickly. She punches Pelos in the face. He wails, falling backward like he's never been hit before, likely because he hasn't. Why would a blue hit another blue? They're test takers, math makers, star charters, not fighters.
I like the rude one, Severo says. Wait, Dominus, I desire the ship.
Another blue slides forward, staring at Pelos on the ground.
I deserve it. Orion is no more than a laggard. Her mastery of astrophysics leaves much to be desired, to say little of her understanding of extraplanetary mass kinetics. She didn't even attend the observatory.
Another blue pushes forward.
Forget Arnas. He's a dotterhead at astrophysics, and his assumptions in theoretical calculus are imprudent at best. I was second in command of this vessel for 6 months under the Ash Lord. I served upon it while it was in its dry berth. Logic supports the maneuver to place me as your captain, Dominus.
The Armada's ships continue to hail us over the comms. Men of war slide closer. Inside their bellies, brave men and women will be donning suits of armor. They'll board leechcraft and shoot into space to land on my hull, burrow their way through, praying that they will make it home to have a meal made by their mother, their spouse. All that while my blues shove and push to lead my ship, howling insults at one another's math skills and academic integrity.
"Don't listen to either of them, Dominus," shouts a woman in that slow accent.
She falls to her knees. "My name is Virga Z. Sederta. I have studied the physics of astral drift in the Midnight School, far superior to the observatory. I hold, among others, a doctorate on dark matter and gravitational lensing. Let me guide your vessel, Dominus. To decide in favor of another would be specious and worse, illogical." These blues should have used their logic and seen that I look only at the woman who does not kneel like the rest of them. Orion, the first to speak, still stands, shoulders square, long neck unbent. Her dialect is low-born, sharper, and more worldly than the dreamy lingo of these academics, likely from the dock city of Phobos, or the string docks near the Academy's Can. If she really is a docker who didn't go to the observatory or the midnight school, I wonder about the story of how she came to be on the bridge in the first place.
"What about all that noise?" I ask Orion, gesturing to the blues. "They're full of batshit, Dominus."
She taps a slender finger against her temple.
"I am not full of batshit."
She smiles and nods to the displays where the other torch ships creep closer.
"And you're running out of time."
I glance to the scanner stations where alerts signal the secretive launch of two leechcraft from the Sovereign's nearby men of war and cruisers.
"I know I can do this, otherwise I would not have spoken out. Give me a chance."
I nod to Severo, and he tosses her the captain's winged star. "Get us to our fleet."
"Rules of engagement?" she asks me.
"Minimal casualties," I say.
"We are good. The Sovereign is the tyrant. That is how this must play." "Aye, Dominus."
I watch with Severo as Orion takes command of my ship and sets orders to rendezvous with Augustus's ships beyond the Rubicon beacons. The squabbling stops as soon as I appoint Orion. They know their chance has passed, so they slip into their comfortable roles as though they wished they'd never left them. Their blue sigils look like tridents against their forearms in this dimmed lighting. There's a curious remoteness to blues. An island people in the abyss of space, they were designed to survive the long journeys from Luna without mutiny. So they share. They share the same oxygen, the same food, the same bunks, the same routines, the same pits, the same commanders, the same lovers, the same sects, the same ambitions. To do their job with precision and rise high through merit so that they might honour their sect. I open a comm channel to the rest of the fleet and the satellites of Luna. They can't stop the signal. Not of this ship. Our arrays are as sophisticated as any in the Sovereign's Navy.
Sons and daughters of society, this is Darrow Au Andromedus of the House Augustus. I bring terrible tidings. Tonight, your Sovereign has broken the compact of our society.
As my master, Arch-Governor Nero Au Augustus, slept under her protection, she made attempt upon his life, the lives of his family, and those of his praetors and aides.
Along with the Bellona, she attempted the illegal and immoral murder of more than 30 peerless scarred. She failed. In retaliation, I have taken one of her flagships, and I am now besieged, with my life, as well as those of my master and his family, at risk. If we do not fight back, we will die. If we surrender, we will die. I have not vented the ship. Those aboard have seen the merit of my cause and have allied themselves with a family that would resist the power-hungry tyrant, Octavia Auloon.
Close enough to the truth.
Hours ago, our Sovereign told me to betray my house, to betray my vows. Like her father before her, she is drunk on power and now believes herself empress. She told us to bow. Witness now our reply.
I turned the comm off.
Mr. Pellis, as you will, Orion declares. Let the bastards have it when they come.
She activates her own tattoos and sinks into digital speak with the rest of the crew. The bridge is silent. A second ticks by, another. On the HC, I watch three greys shoot a gold in the head. In the hangars, oranges huddle to the side as golds lead war colours against the downed stork. Then Ragnar arrives in the hangar, and the oranges rally around him, as do armed reds who followed him from the halls. Many die. Something furious grips these colours. And though they die, I feel the flickering of rebellion as I give them permission to do what they've wanted to do their entire lives. It's there, even if you never see it till the end. That spark of individuality, of freedom. The door of the stork pops open, and Mustang charges out with my howlers to aid the low colours and Ragnar, though even the Telemannuses keep their distance from the monstrous man. Beyond my vessel, the enemy ships finally show their menace. The scanners swell with red. Enemies, leechcraft freshly split from the bellies of the armada around us, streak through space to find our hull. They aim to take us by storm. Orion opens broadsides.
It's so beautiful, several murmurs.
I stand in silence. Railgun payloads slam through leechcraft, shearing away metal and men, only to carry on and smash into the hulls and shields of the same men of war that launched the leechcraft. My newly appointed captain paces the command plank, arms crossed. My 5 kilometer war vessel begins a roll, cycling through her banks of railguns as they hurl death into the face of the Sovereign's fleet. Orion half turns to face me, smirking for all to see.
Now, about carving that path, Dominus.
She orders the engines to pound black matter. We shoot forward through the remains of 2 men of war. My bridge is silent but for the buzz of technical orders. Missiles flash in concert beyond our hull. We deploy our flak screens, as the enemy has now deployed theirs, rendering missiles worthless. An aura of light surrounds us like a no-man's land. Railgun ordnance smashes into our hull, though we do not feel the reverberations here on the bridge. Our equipment does not spark.
Wiring does not fall from overhead compartments. This ship is the pinnacle of 700 years of design. Severo nudges me. We might just gory well make it. The armada around us is massive, beyond massive. It was brought here to make the gathered lords and all their fleets out past the Rubicon beacons tremble, and still it is not half the combined fleet. But now that very armada quakes from the inside like a corpulent body as some alien chews its way out of the host. We make our escape from the armada in quick fashion. They do not pursue us past the Rubicon beacons, where they are joined by our small fleet, as well as those of the Cordovan and Telemanuses, the Norvo. I hope more will flock to our banners after today's last surprise. I examine our wake, naval detritus. Bodies of men and women float behind my vessel. They came out of cracked and punctured ships. Some are still alive, but will soon freeze or suffocate. More dead in my path. How many will it take? I leave Orion, the bridge. Severo and I find our way to the engineering bay, where we have oranges cut us out of our mangled suits. We rush from there to the hangar, a vast metal depot scattered with ships, equipment, and now broken men. Yellows dart about aiding the wounded and carting them off to the medbay, greys and oranges helping carry. Weed prods several unarmed gulls with his razor. Pebble and Harpy help the yellows. My eyes search frantically for Mustang. I find her under one of the battered stork's wings, speaking with her father. A long wound mangles her left arm. I don't mention it. They were boarded by a leechcraft and managed to shear the other off when entering the hangar. We've put the bulk of the Sovereign's fleet behind us, I tell Augustus. Where's Quinn? Severo asks sharply. Did they get her to the medbay yet? Mustang does not answer. Instead, she looks to the ramp of the stork, where Roke descends, carrying Quinn in his arms. She's pale, long, and lifeless. Severo does not move, does not speak. His nostrils flare as a breath catches in his chest, a pitiful sob locked tight in the boy who never cries. He goes numb, ghost-like, and I reach for him, but he pulls away, not in anger, but in confusion, as though he was told the future once, and this reality is not what was promised. He stumbles backward, away from our body, looking around, before turning and fleeing the hangar. Roke walks past me with Quinn. His face is slack and tired. He wants to say something bitter, but he bites his tongue and just shakes his head at me. He still does not know why I attacked him in his room before the gala. And now this. I've never seen him so broken. Look at her, he tells me. Darrow, look at your friend. I look at Quinn and feel everything go quiet. Here she is, peaceful in death. Why can we not breathe life back into her? Why can we not simply restart the day, do everything right, save the ones we love? Roke moves away with Quinn toward the hangar's transparent pulse field, which opens into space. He's bent and broken as he walks to the stars to push his lost girl out among them. I grab the jackal when I see him exit the stork, demanding to know what happened. She died, he tells me. It's just that. He's tired like the rest of us. He rolls down his sleeves. I won't apologize. I did my best. Of course you did, I say, shaking myself. Of course. He asks me where my helmet cam is. I stare at him. The footage, he says.
Do you even understand what you just did? He waves around. Two men took one of the greatest vessels ever built. Golds will flock to our banners. All it takes is my media and your story.
I tell him absently, almost forgetting the data recorder the Sons of Ares put in my tooth to record the bomb blast. It's activated with a clench of my molars. I clenched them as soon as I sat down in the Sovereign's office. I reach inside my mouth and delicately pry it loose of the gums. It is smaller than a hair. The jackal's eyes light up. "Where did you get this?" he asks.
"Black market," I say. "Sovereign has damned herself. Use the recording. Make this war a fair fight."
I leave the jackal there, and am about to leave the clean-up to others when I notice the oranges and low colours watching me. I can't simply lead with violence. So I join Pebble and Harpy and lend my aid in helping the wounded to the med bay. The rest of the howlers help too. And Mustang. And eventually, even Victra. After the last grey is loaded on a gurney, I stand in the empty hangar. Augustus has gone to the bridge. The jackal avoids the telemanuses who accompany him and instead makes for the communication hub. I'm left alone. Roke is gone. I don't know what to do. Where to go? Blood and scorch marks stain the deck. I look at my hands. These are the consequences of my actions, and I feel so alone. I lean my head against the cold metal wall. She comes from behind. I don't think she says my name. I'm not sure. I just smell her damp hair as her arms wrap around me, squeezing tightly. "I know you're tired," Mustang says quietly, "but Severo needs you." "What about Roke?" I ask, turning to face her. So much lingers unsaid between us. So many questions unanswered. So many crimes left unforgiven. So much anger, and perhaps still the faint flicker of something more. I feel it as she cups my neck and lets the strength in her fingers lend itself to me. "Not now," she says. "Roke blames me, and he should. They all should blame me. And it's only going to get worse."
Chapter 23. Trust.
I find him in a communal washroom. He's earned one of the staterooms that the others are claiming for the return voyage to Mars, but that's not how he thinks. "This is still the boy you hid in the horse."
"No," I think. "Not a boy any longer."
"She cared for you, Severo." His arms cross before him, freckled and thin. A towel wraps around his waist, another hangs around his shoulders. Golds don't care about nudity, but Severo always has. He's gained a tattoo since last I saw him. A huge black and grey wolf along his back. The howlers are his everything. Once they were just a tool to me. Now I think of them as something more. But what does that mean when I use them just the same? He stares at the water running into the drain of the shower. Down and down it spirals.
"In the end, I believe I'll enjoy war," he says. "Gotta toughen my spine a bit. Callous my hands. Bastards tell us it's all roses and glory." He looks up. "Don't you smell the roses, Reaper?" I sit beside him on the bench.
"Did you hear what I said?"
"Course I gory heard you. I'm missing an eye, not an ear."
He taps his bionic eye with a bony finger.
"Course I know she cared.
but never in the way I wanted. She deserved to live. If any of us ugly little shit-eaters deserve it, it was her. There wasn't a cruel bone in her body. Not one. But it didn't matter. It doesn't matter if we're good or we're evil. It's all up to chance. It was chance you knew her at all, I say. Chance that brought her to House Mars. No, it was my father, Severo says. He drafted her, traded a pick with Juno to get her. He shakes his head, all because he thought she would temper us, govern our anger. If he hadn't picked her, we wouldn't have met her and she'd be alive. Maybe, I say, thinking of Io. But she chose to come here. She chose to follow me, to follow you. Just like Pax. I nod, touching my Pegasus. It's all piss and shit, isn't it? Severo says. Doesn't matter how pretty they dress it up. We're still in the game. We're always going to be in a slagging game. Spit on their empire. Spit on this piss and this shit. I came for you because he told me what you are. I stare at him, unable to understand. What do you mean? I ask with a nervous laugh. Turn it on, he says. I know you brought one. You're thorough, Reaper. Always thorough. Why are you acting so... Shut up and turn it on. I nod and activate the device in my pocket. A jam field deploys. I'm not so prideful as the Sovereign to believe no one could listen in. Severo stares at me till I shift uncomfortably. So, what am I? I ask. Even now, he asks, shaking his head. You are wound tight. Say the name of the person who sent me. Mustang sent you. You told me she brought you in from the rim. Same with all the howlers. That's right. She did. Took 6 months to get here from Pluto. But guess who came to me during my layover in Triton? Go on, Reap. Guess. Lorne? His lips curl into a sneer. Fitchner? Severo spits in my face right under the eye. Guess wrong again, and I leave you like this. He snaps his fingers. I will not come back. I will not help you. I will not bleed for you. I will not sacrifice my friends for a man who doesn't give enough of a shit about me to put his neck out just once. Trust goes both ways, Darrow. This time, you have to take a leap. He's not bluffing. And I know what I want to say. But how can it be? Severo's a gold. A bloody damn gold. He heard me say bloody damn to Apollo. He covered it up. Didn't he? Or was that a mistake? Is he trapping me? No. No, if that's true, then the game is already over. Io's dream has failed. Who is closer to me than he? Who loves me more than this strange, nasty outcast? No one. So I look him in his dull gold eyes. Ares sent you. Silence between us. A terrible 5 seconds. 6, 7. He stands and locks the door before pulling a small black crystal from the pocket of his crumpled pants. For your breath only. A whisper jam. I take it tenderly, knowing how much it costs, and blow against its surface. My breath makes it wobble, then shatter. Small motes of black rise, drifting up like fireflies out of the grass as dusk settles in deep summer. They coalesce, floating and forming a rough hollow that hovers between Severo and me. The spiked helmet of Ares. My son, he warbles. I am sorry. Harmony has betrayed me and initiated a campaign against our principles. I discovered her intended use of you too late, but you were wise. This is why I chose you. Steps are being taken to curb her efforts. Continue with your own. Set Augustus against Bologna and fracture the Pax Solaris.
I try to ask it a question, but it is a recording, made sometime after the gala.
I realize this must be difficult. I have asked too much of you already, but you must carry on. Sow chaos. Weaken them. You have much reason to doubt me. We have not contacted you until now, because you were watched by Pliny, by the Jackal, and by the Sovereign spies. Troublemakers breed interest, but I have watched you too, and I am proud. I know Io would be as well. In case you doubt the veracity of this message, a friend would like to say hello. Ares' helmet fades, and Dancer smiles at me.
Darrow, I want you to know, we're with you. Your family is alive and well. The end is coming, my friend. Soon you'll be with us. Till then, trust the man Ares sent. I recruited him myself. Break the chains.
The image erodes, blackish light decaying into the air, and I'm left staring at the shower floor.
You look good for all that surgery, Severo says. His smile is no less nasty than usual.
Ares sent that cripple to me, the one who sent you to the Institute, Dancer.
He can't say any more because I'm hugging him and crying. I sob and hold on to him, shaking, scaring him. He doesn't move except to pat me on the head. All the weight falls from my shoulders. Someone knows. He knows and he's here. He knows and he came to help me. To help me. I can't stop shaking and saying thank you.
Io was right. I was right.
You are my friend.
I tremble out like a child. It almost makes him cry seeing me this way. A true friend.
Of course, he says haltingly. But only if you stop blubbering, man. We're still goals.
I pull back from him, embarrassed, wiping my face on my sleeve. I think I mumble an apology. My vision's bleary. I sniff. He hands me a towel, which I blow my running nose into. He makes a face.
What? That was for your eyes.
We laugh together, and then sit in an awkward silence. In time, I ask him how long he's known. He suspected something since the Institute, he says, when he heard me say bloody damn to Apollo. My voice went all thick, all rusty. Then Dancer showed him the video of my carving.
Somehow they knew you could trust me, even if you didn't, shithead. Always been that way. Always will be that way.
It doesn't bother you, I ask him. What I am.
Bother? That's a tiny-ass word for a gory big thing.
He scratches his buzzed head.
A crotch rash bothers me. Bad fish bothers me. Entitled dickweeds bother me. This?
He shrugs. Piss on it. You like my angle more than any other pisshead in the world. Figure I'd return the favour. Even if I really am bigger than your rusty ass.
I laugh at that. He would have dwarfed my red self.
You must know what I'm here to do. It isn't just infiltration. It will end with the fall of the society.
Rise too high, in mud you lie.
That's it? I ask incredulously. You're on board? He snorts.
It took me 6 months on a torch ship to reach you. 3 months from Triton after Dancer showed me the truth. Was I confused? Damn straight. But still, I boarded the ship and had 3 months to reconsider. Still, I am here. So, I think the time for second-guessing my commitment has passed. Anyway, my gold brethren have been trying to kill me since I was born. He looks around, uncomfortable even after all we've shared, despite the jam field. Only people to ever treat me decently, or people who don't have a reason to. Low colours. You. I think it's time to return the favour.
And what of the others? I ask intensely. Pebble. Clown.
Not my secret to share. Quinn would have understood, he says slowly, fighting back something. Rest might go along. Thistle won't. Roke won't, not in a million years. Too in love with their own species. Don't know about the tall, arrogant one. Victra. And Mustang? I ask.
I don't give love advice, shithead.
He stands. Say, just because I'm a revolutionary doesn't mean I can't get a massage from a pink, does it?
That would suck sack.
I don't know, I laugh. I'm still figuring it out, to be honest.
Slag it, I'm getting one.
Back feels bloody broken.
His crooked teeth bare themselves as he laughs. Feels good. That's how I know it's right, Reap. Despite all this shit, it feels good in here.
He taps his thin chest.
It feels, how do you say, bloody damn good.
Victra finds me after I've said my goodbyes to Severo.
Augusta sent me to tell you the Ash Lord's stateroom is yours.
Augustus is giving me the largest room.
Your ship, your spoils, he said. You know how particular he is about order.
I hope you know the way. I'm already lost.
She motions me along.
We walk in silence through the halls. I'm weary, but happy enough, knowing Severo is with me, that Ares still believes in me, and that Danzer is still alive out there. It's a salve on the pain from Quinn's death.
I suppose you know my family has betrayed the Arch-Governor, she says.
I'd heard, but you're still with us.
As I said, I do what I want. Mother doesn't control me or my accounts, like she does Antonio's.
She grins sideways, watching me. I like you when you're like this.
Like this? I can't help but laugh.
What do you mean?
I don't know. You seem calm. At ease, despite what's happened.
And you seem particularly kind, I say.
Kind? A quaint fiction.
But we both know I'm far from kind. We walk in silence till we reach the door to my stateroom. I glance back and see Ragnar trailing in the halls behind. If it weren't for the bandages on his body, I wouldn't have seen him at all. I motion him away. At the door, I search Victra's haughty eyes.
You could have sent a low color to tell me I was to be in the stateroom.
But then I wouldn't get to see you.
Is that the only reason? I ask.
She smiles mischievously.
I think I'll keep my secrets.
After a moment, she looks up at me. But I do worry for you.
For me? I roll my eyes.
What are you playing at, Victra?
Nothing,
she says, offended.
You're such a hypocrite, Darrow.
Me?
Remember when Tactus discarded your violin because he was suspicious that you wanted something? Now you treat me the same way. Same as when I came to you in the gardens on Luna. Is it too much to believe I am your friend and care about you?
She wrinkles her nose.
You're making me emotional, and I hate it.
I'm sorry, I say. You're just
I try to find the right words for the tall woman. There aren't any, so I shrug and say, "It's hard knowing you're Antonia's sister. That's the full of it."
"But I'm not her."
I realize that...
"Do you?"
She reaches out and touches my face. Her lips part searchingly. I remember the feel of them on mine before I launched myself through the spit tube. I let her kiss me then. Even if she is a cold woman, there is something in her heart for me. Different from Io, different from Mustang. I move gently away from her hand and shake my head.
"You are a strange man,"
she says with a soft sigh, all the vulnerability that was in her now gone. Her claws return. She leans back against the wall opposite me, bending a knee and putting a boot on the wall, laughing at me with her eyes. Here's the Victor I know.
"You love women, but you do not enjoy us."
Smile lines crease as her lips part slightly. My eyes cannot help but trace the slender contours of her neck, the strength in her slim shoulders, and the rise of her breasts. Her eyes burn into me.
"There's much to enjoy. Do you even know how soft my skin is?"
I cough out a laugh. "You're mocking me."
"As ever."
Victor is a schemer. It's her way. But for a moment she was vulnerable, and seeing that made all the difference. I kill the sexual tension the best way I know how. "Good night, sister," I say, and kiss her on the brow.
"Sister? Sister?"
She laughs dismissively as I leave. It takes her a moment, but she calls to me.
"Is it because you think me wicked?"
I turn back to her.
"Wicked? Is that why you've never wanted me?"
She pauses, choosing her words with care.
"Because you look down on me?"
"Why would you think that?" I ask gently. She shrugs and looks around the hall, strangely hesitant.
"I don't."
She twists her hands, trying to wring out the right words. She gestures to herself.
"This is how I survive. Do you understand? It's how my mother taught me. It's what works."
"What do you say we try something new?" I offer, walking back to her. I extend a hand. "Darrow, contrary to popular rumor, I don't eat glass. I love music, dancing, and I'm very fond of fresh fruit, particularly strawberries." She snorts a laugh.
"So stupid.
We're reintroducing ourselves."
"No armor, just two people."
"I'm waiting," I say playfully. Rolling her eyes, she steps forward, looking either way down the hall. She brings up her hand, fighting back a childish smile.
"Victor, I like the way stone smells before rain falls."
She makes a face, cheeks flushing red.
"And, don't laugh, I actually hate the color gold. Green goes better with my complexion."
I cannot sleep. The bodies of those I've left behind float in the darkness with me. I wake a dozen times, flashes of bombs, slashing of swords ripping into my dreams. I earned these sleepless nights. I know that, and that's what makes them all the harder. I stand and pace my new quarters, wandering its expanse. 6 rooms, a small gymnasium, a large bath, a study, all belonging to the man who burned a moon. The father of the Furies. How could I sleep in a room like this?
I take the Pegasus pendant from my pocket, almost forgetting it's a radium bomb. Wandering the halls of the ship, ghost-like, I look behind me, wondering if Ragnar follows. I told him to sleep, but I know little of his moods, how he thinks, what he does at night. There is much to learn. I pass through dimmed halls, past orange technicians and blue systems operators, who quiet and bend as I pass through metal halls down to the bowels of the ship where golds never tread. The ceilings are lower, meant for the red workers and brown janitors. This ship is a city, an island. All the colours are here. I remember the roster. Thousands of jobs, millions of moving parts. I examine a maintenance panel. What if the orange who worked it were to overload the panel? What would happen? I don't know. I wager a few golds really do. I make a note of it. I continue on, hunger drawing me to the mess hall. Food could easily be delivered to my rooms, but my valets have not yet been organized. Anyway, I hate being waited on. In the mess hall, I find someone as sleepless as myself, sitting at a long metal table. Mustang. Chapter 24. Bacon and Eggs. I slide across from her. Can't sleep? I ask. She wraps her knuckles against her head. Lot rattling round. She nods to the clamour of pans back in the kitchens. The cook's beside himself, she says. Thinks I need a feast. Told him I just wanted bacon and eggs. Pretty sure he disregarded everything I said. He babbled something about pheasant. Has this earth-born accent, hard to understand. Moments later, a brown cook stumbles out from the kitchen carrying a tray of not only bacon and eggs, but pumpkin waffles, cured ham, cheeses, sausages, fruits, and a dozen other dishes. But no pheasant. His eyes turn the size of waffles when he sees me. Apologizing for something, he sets the tray down and disappears, only to reappear a minute later with even more food. How much do you think we eat? I ask him. He just stares at me. Thank you, Mustang says. He mumbles something inaudible and backs away, bowing. I think the Ash Lord was a bit different from us, I say. Mustang pushes the fruit toward me. Thought you didn't like bacon, I say. She shrugs. I had it every morning on Luna. She delicately butters her waffles. Reminded me of you. She avoids my eyes. Why can't you sleep? Not much good at it. You never were, except when you have a hole in your stomach. You slept like a baby then. I laugh. I think comas don't count. We talk about anything but the things we should. Innocent and quiet, like two moths dancing around the same flame. Amazing how big the beds are, even on a starship, Mustang says. Mine's monstrous. Too big, really. Finally, someone else agrees. Half the time I sleep on the floor. You too? She shakes her head. Sometimes I hear noises and sleep in the closet, thinking if someone's coming for me, they won't look there. I've done that. Really does help. Except when the closet is big enough to fit a family of obsidians, then it's just as bad. She frowns suddenly. I wonder if obsidians cuddle. They don't. Her eyebrows rise. Have you researched it? I finish a handful of strawberries, shrugging as Mustang frowns at my manners. Obsidians believe in three types of touch. The touch of spring, the touch of summer, the touch of winter. After the Dark Revolt, where the Obsidians rose in arms against the Iron Ancestors, the Board of Quality Control debated destroying the entire colour. You know how they gave them religion, stole their technology, but what they wished to kill most of all was the incredible kinship the Obsidians then possessed. So they instructed the shaman of the tribes, bought and paid for liars, to warn against touch, saying it weakened the spirit. So now, the Obsidians touch one another in sex. They touch each other to prevent death, and they touch each other to kill. No cuddling. I notice her watching me with a small smirk. But of course you knew all that.
I did.
She smiles. But sometimes it's nice to remember all that's going on inside you. Oh. I look away as she tries to hold my gaze.
I forgot you can blush.
She watches me for a moment.
You probably don't know this, but one of my dissertations on Luna concentrated on mistakes in the sociological manipulation theorems used by the Board of Quality Control.
She cuts a sausage delicately. I deemed them short-sighted. The chemical sexual sterilization of the pink genus, for instance, has led to a tragically high suicide rate within the gardens.
Tragically. Most would have said inefficient.
The rigidity of laws maintaining the hierarchy are so strict they'll one day break. 50 years from now? 100? Who knows? There was this one case we studied where a gold woman fell in love with an obsidian. They had a black market carver alter their reproductive organs so his seed was compatible with her eggs. They were found out and both were executed. The carvers killed.
But things like this have happened 100 times. 1,000. They're just scrubbed from the record books.
It's terrible, I say. And beautiful.
Beautiful? I ask, repulsed.
No one knows of these people, she says. No one but a handful of ghouls with access. The human spirit tries to break free again and again, not in hate like the Dark Revolt, but for love. They don't mimic each other. They aren't inspired by others who come before them. Each is willing to take the leap, thinking they are the first. That's bravery. And that means it's a part of who we are as people.
Bravery. Would she say that if she knew one of those people sat across from her? Does she live in the world of theories Harmony spoke of? Or could she really understand?
So how long, I wonder, she continues, till a group like the Sons of Ares finds the records, broadcasts them? They did it with Persephone, the girl who sang. It's only a matter of time.
She pauses, squinting at me as I react involuntarily to the mention of Io.
What's wrong?
I can't tell her what I'm thinking, so I lie. Dissertations, sociology. You and I specialize in very different things. I always wondered what your life was like on Luna. Mustang eyes me playfully.
Oh? So you thought about me?
Maybe.
Day and night. What is Mustang wearing? What is she dreaming about? What boy is she kiss?
She winces at that last part.
Darrow, I want to explain something.
You don't have to, I say, waving her off.
With Cassius, it... Mustang, you don't owe me anything. You weren't mine. You aren't mine. You can do what you want, when you want, with whomever you want.
I pause, even though he is a gory damn jackass. She snorts a laugh. The humour fades as fast as it came. There's pain in her eyes, in her half-opened mouth. Her idle knife and fork hover over her forgotten plate. She looks down and shakes her head. "I wanted it to be different," she murmurs. "You know that." Mustang. I rest my hand on her wrist. Despite her strength, it's frail in my hard hands. Frail as the other girl's was when I held her in the deep mines. I couldn't help that girl. And now I feel like I can't help this woman. Would that my hands were meant to build. I would know what to say, what to do. Maybe in another life, I would have been that man. In this one, my words, like my hands, are clumsy. All they can do is cut. All they can do is break. I think I know how you feel. Mustang jerks back from me.
How I feel?
I didn't mean... I pause, hearing a noise. We look over and the cook stands there awkwardly with another tray. He tiptoes forward, sets it down, and then leaves the room, backing away awkwardly. Dara, shut up and listen. She peers fiercely up at me through the strands of hair that have fallen across her face.
You want to know how I feel? I'll spit it out at you. All my life I've been taught to regard my family over all else. What happened with my brother at the Institute, when I handed him over to you, that set me against everything I was raised to do. But I thought that you...
She takes a deep breath that wavers at the end. Were a person who earned my loyalty. And I thought that it would be so much more important if I gave it to you in that moment than to Adrius, who has never lifted a finger on my behalf. I knew it was the right thing to do, but it was a repudiation of my father, of all he taught me.
Do you even know what that means? He has broken families as easily as other men break sticks. He wields unimaginable power. But more than that, he is the man who taught me to ride horses, to read poems, and not just the military histories. The man who stood beside me, letting me raise myself up by my own strength when I fell. The man who couldn't look at me for 3 years after my mother died. That is the man I rejected for you. No, she corrects herself, not for you. For living differently. Living for more. More than pride. At the Institute, you and I decided to break the rules, to be decent in a place of horror.
So we made an army of loyal friends instead of slaves. We chose to be better. Then you spat in the face of that by leaving to become one of my father's killers. She puts a finger in the air. No, don't speak. It's not your turn just because I pause. She takes her time in gathering her thoughts, pushing away her plate. Now, I'm sure you understand that I felt lost. One, because I thought I'd found someone special in you. Two, because I felt you were abandoning the idea that gave us the ability to conquer Olympus. Consider that I was vulnerable, lonely, and that perhaps I fell into Cassius's bed because I was hurt and needed a salve to my pain. Can you imagine that? You may answer.
I squirm on my cushion. I suppose.
Good. Now shove that idea up your arse. Her lips make a hard line. I am not some frill-wearing tramp. I am a genius. I say this because it is a fact. I am smarter than any person you've ever met, except perhaps my twin. My heart does not make my brain a fool. I sought out a relationship with Cassius for the same reason I let the Sovereign think she was turning me against my father. To protect my family.
She looks down at her food. I've always been able to manipulate people. Men, women, it makes no difference. Cassius was a walking wound, Darrow. Raw and bloody, despite the fact it's been 2 years since you killed Julian. I saw it in him in a second, and I knew how I could make him love me. I gave him someone who would listen, someone who would fill the void. The sternness in her voice fades. She looks around as if she could escape the conversation she started. If she stopped, I would be happier for it. I made him think he could not live without me. I knew it was the only thing that could keep the rest of my house safe. I knew it was the best weapon I could wield in this game. Yet, I felt so cold, so horrible, like I was the cruel witch snaring Odysseus, making him fall in love, keeping him from my own selfish aims. It seemed so logical. And when he put his arms around me, I felt like I was drowning, like I was lost, suffocating under the weight of all I'd done, suffocating knowing there was a life ahead of me with someone I did not love. Yet it was for family. It was for the people I love, even if they don't deserve it. Many have sacrificed more. I could sacrifice that. She shakes her head. The tears that built there mirroring those that well in my own eyes. They fall when she says, "Then you walked in at the gala and it was like the ground had broken open to swallow me. I felt like a fraud, a wicked girl who'd contrived a reason to do something stupid." She tries to wipe her eyes. "Can't you see why I did it? I didn't want you to die. I don't want you to die, not like my brother Claudius, not like Pax. I would have done anything to stop it."
"I can stop it." "You're not invincible, Darrow. I know you think you are. But one day you'll find out you aren't as strong as you think you are, and I'll be alone."
She goes silent, as all that has welled up inside her breaks loose. She does not sob, but the tears come. She's the type of woman to be embarrassed by them. It breaks me to see this. "You are not wicked," I say, as I take her hand in mine. "You are not cruel." She shakes her head, trying to pull away. I take her jaw between the fingers of my right hand and bend her head till her eyes find a home in mine. "And what you do for the people you love cannot be judged. Do you understand?" I deepen my voice. "Do you understand?" She nods. It should not be this way. The Gulls have everything. Yet they demand sacrifices even from their own. This place is sick. This empire broken. It eats its kings, its queens, as hungrily as it does the paupers who mill its earth. But it cannot have this woman as it had the girl I buried. I will not let it devour her. I will not let it devour my family in Lycos. I will break it, even if it claims me in the end. I wipe the tears from her face with my thumb. She is different from her people, and when she tries to do as they do, it cracks her heart to the core. Looking at her, I know I was wrong. She's not a distraction. She does not compromise my mission. She is the point of it all. Yet I cannot kiss her. Not now, when I must break her heart to break this empire.
It would not be fair. I've fallen in love with her, but she's fallen for my lies.
You can't trust him,
she says quietly. Who? I ask, startled by her sudden words.
My twin.
She whispers as though he sits in the corner of the room.
He's not a man like you. He's something else. When he looks at us, when he looks at people, he sees sacks of bone and meat. We don't really exist to him.
I frown as she clutches my hand.
Darrow, listen to me. He is the monster they don't know how to write stories about. You cannot trust him.
The way she says it makes me know she understands our pact. I don't trust him, I say. But I need him.
We can win this war without him, she says.
I thought you said I wasn't strong enough.
You're not,
she says with a smile. Not by yourself. She dons her lopsided grin.
You need me.
If only it were so simple. I leave Mustang for my rooms soon after. The halls are quiet, and I feel a shade drifting through some metal realm. I don't know how to accept her help, or how I should handle her. Seeing her with Cassius wounded me more than I'll ever tell her, and part of me knows not all of it could have been a manipulation. He was never a monster, and if he ever becomes one, I know it'll be because of me. The door to my suite hisses open. A hand settles over my shoulder. I turn to see Ragnar's chest. I didn't even hear him.
Someone breathes inside.
Theodora, probably. She's my pink steward. You like her?
Gold breath.
I nod, not asking how he knows, and take my razor from my arm. It whispers into a sword as I step through. The lights are on, muted. I search the suite's rooms with Ragnar to find the jackal sitting in my lounge with a sherry. He chuckles at our weapons.
I do admit, I am quite threatening.
He's wearing a bathrobe and slippers. I excuse Ragnar. With his wounds, he should be resting. Reluctantly, he trudges out. Seems no one sleeps on this ship, I say, as I join the jackal on the couch. I imagine we have to restructure our arrangement a bit.
Fond of understatements, aren't you?
He sips the liquor and sighs.
Thought I'd drown in that damn lagoon. I always thought my death would be something grand. Launched into the sun, beheaded by a political rival.
Then when it came... He shudders, looking so very frail and boyish. It was just a careless coldness, like the rocks of the Institute falling all around me again, in that mine. He's right. There is no warmth in death. I cried like a child when I thought I was dying after Cassius stabbed me.
Obviously, this changes our strategy, but I don't believe it must change our alliance.
Nor do I agree. We'll need your spies more than ever. Pliny won't take my ascension lightly, and you're stuck here in your father's court. The Politico will try to remove us both. I make no mention of the sons of Ares. As I guessed, they were forgotten by all as soon as I tipped that wine into Cassius's lap.
Pliny will have to go, but you and I should maintain social distance until then, so he doesn't know the threat against him is unified. Better for him to misunderstand our individual resources.
And so the Telemannuses still talk with me, I say.
True, they do want me dead.
As they should. I don't begrudge them it. It's just damn inconvenient. He hands me a holocom from his pocket. They're synced. I'll be calling my ships to meet us, and I imagine you'll stay here with your new prize. Wouldn't do to have shuttles going back and forth. I want to ask him about Leto. Why he killed him. But why show a devil you know his strength? It just makes me a threat to him. And I've seen how he deals with threats. Better to play ignorant and make sure I'm always useful. War presents us with more opportunities, I say, depending on how far we want it to spread.
I do believe I take your meaning.
All others will try to suffocate the flames, to preserve what they have, especially Pliny and your sister.
Well, then we must be cleverer.
She doesn't get hurt. That part of our agreement is static. If ever she's wounded, I believe it'll be from you, not me. He might be right.
But I'm on your level. Fan the flames. Spread the war. Win it. Take the spoils.
I think I know just how to do it. What can your network tell me about the shipyards of Ganymede?